that they be here, because then they can hear other parties. So, Alan, Larry, are they coming? Are they here? Are you here? Okay. When they are here, let me know. We need to acknowledge them. Thank them for their cooperation. Thirdly, we urge once again those who are here to stay if they can for the whole day. Because you hear what other people have to say. And then you can make further submissions to us. Based on what you hear other people say. We encourage a dialogue, if you like. And as you know, in this committee, where possible, we allow different parties to talk to each other, depending on the time management. But we really, in the two committees, we feel we should have a dialogue rather than what we call a conveyor belt system, where you come and make a submission, take questions, and then leave, without hearing other parties. As you know, in these two committees, we allow submissions till the day before we vote on a vote. With this one, the VAT bill in particular, we're pleading with Momo and his team. And that's the first thing they have to do. Is tell us what has happened since the hearing on the fiscal framework vote. We are going to meet with the parties in contention over the VAT bill, both to support or and those who oppose it, and to continue to have a process. Now, he spoke then, Comrade Jay, you'll recall, of an independent panel bringing the parties together to strike some compromises, if possible. Ultimately, Parliament will decide the decisions, make the decisions on the VAT increase. Apart from that, I don't know, Michelle, if you want to say anything, but those are my preliminary remarks for what they were. For one more thing, I engaged Mr. Mania. I was thank him. He agreed. Sorry? Yeah. Well, for one, he was conciliatory. I don't know what he spoke. How much do I have said? Right. So, he said it's fine. He's going to ask a very inane question to this. So, it doesn't really matter that he won't be here from 2 to half past 2. Because, in any case, he has very inane questions to ask in this committee. So, we won't miss it, Tuddy. But I don't want to see you, sir. Thank you. Mr. Mania has kindly agreed that it's a thing I must explain to the civil society. The Deputy Secretary was going to answer questions tomorrow, but for a variety of reasons, I think the Chief was there last week and decided to bring it forward to today. So they said, no, we can sit till whenever we want. And Mr. Mania is the only one who's participating in the debate. So he'll be away from 2 to 10. So we're thankful for the cooperation.
Thank you, also, welcome to all the members, also the members of the Select Committee for Finance and the National Council of Provinces. We are very proud of my voice. We are becoming part of this process, although we are dealing with the draft bill to bring the NCP earlier on board in processing renewables. Why? Because the referral sometimes comes very late in October, and then we must rush through it to pass the bills before Parliament, the NCP wise in December. And that is, it was ample time to do the work thoroughly, but in a case like this, where this bill deals with that, we're going to take it a step further because we've got a provincial mandate in the NCP to take it to province so that all the poor people can come to Cape Town to come and sit here to fight again, that we go and listen to them. Where we come from. So thank you, Chair, for the introduction words and what you do. Thank you.
The chairs have agreed that I'll take time and responsibility for the first half. Charles will take time and responsibility for the second half. I also take this opportunity to welcome from Kai Richard and other neighboring councils the people who are here to express their opposition to the VAT. They seem to be the members, it's their right to be here, and we welcome them.
hope somebody is translating for those who are not English or following people. But they have two guys that can hear you better. Yeah, we know that I'm just in that regard. But Parliament should look into that problem. Thing. I don't know how we manage it, but they should be translating what I'm coming to observe. We have repeatedly said also, before a meeting, members let us know that they want to speak in whatever language they want. In our committee, people are quite down to speak in English. Frankly, that's their right. So we can arrange that time if we So, I don't know if somebody's helping with translation there, but I hope that he is arranged for that. Can we move on and say that despite the silly banter from my side, this is an especially serious issue. In fact, the most challenging for those of us who've been here since 2014 in this committee, and probably for all committees since 1994, it's the first ever BAG increase. The process by which it's done has raised the ire of NGOs and civil society and made us think also on what we need to do in the Money Bills Act, although we must tell you that the first part of processing the Money Bills Act is over. In our report, we will raise all of the issues that you have raised in the fiscal framework public hearing. Can Sakele note that, and I'm telling you, we should put those issues while they're calling about a minister announcing a VAT increase and in terms of the VAT Act becoming for the data we have announced. Now, can we move over then very quickly to National Treasury? Can you first start with what have you done since the last meeting, what you plan to do, and we'll alert you by the end of the day but the aim is not to do a finalization of the store, but we're doing it swifter than we've ever done it before because of the serious concerns of civil society about the implications of this incremental VAT increase. We also have to take into account that if we take certain decisions about the VAT increase, it will have implications probably for the Appropriations Committee. So we also need to take all those things into account, and the two chairs will confer about it, look at our program to see how we manage this process. But the initial aim is for the NA to finish this process before we arrive at the end of this quarter, which we targeted as the first week of January, that's Friday. First week of June, sorry. We'll sit in committee, hold it. We'll confirm it here and see how your program is. Thank you very much. Over to you, Mo.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. And I think just to start off, I think that we are here to discuss the rates bill, but I'm trying to remind myself about the actual budget. Because it's obviously linked to the budget that was delivered in February, and in particular to the huge or the big revenue gap that we had to close of 36 billion rand. That's over and above the, on the one hand, the strong measures that have to be taken to cut expenditure just to reach the expenditure ceiling. And of course to accommodate the higher education allocation for free higher education that got implemented progressively starting with year one. But I think the context sort of does matter greatly. I think it's also just important to bear in mind that the size of our deficit obviously was a big factor for the fact that we weren't stabilizing our debt to GDP was a big factor for the rating agencies. And remember that at the time of the budget, we still faced the Moody's ratings decision. Post-budget, of course, and given that thing, both the steps taken in the budget and some of the announcements made by the President sort of did lead to a successful outcome with regard to the Moody's review, which maintained our investment grade with a stable outlook. So that was a very positive And I think underlying that, the budget clearly did play a big role. They were waiting for the budget to see how we would take steps to stabilize our debt to GDP. So I think that context is important. That's the first slide. Okay. So the total shortfall that we were looking at in 2017-18 was 48.2 billion. It's just slightly lower than what we had projected in the MTBPS. And the tax proposals, in particular, had to raise 36 billion. I do want to refer members back to the budget review. I think that we made a number of significant tax proposals, and not only on VAT, but they were related to personal income tax. They were related to the fuel levy and a number of other proposals related to the state duty and so on. Obviously, we also deal with tax issues in Annex B, which deals with the revenue that's foregone through tax incentives, for example, or as you call them, tax expenditure. And I think just for members' information, and just to remind ourselves, the latest bill was published on Budget Day. The formal name, what's it, rates and monetary threshold, it's a mouthful. I had to convince someone in the presidency that it was one bill, because it has an N in there as well, and it's not two bills. And this was sort of published on our website, and it deals with the key rates and threshold changes. Okay, and it's meant to be as simple conceptually in that it makes the big decisions on how your numbers change, and doesn't really normally get into base changes and so on. That and more complex changes we leave for the later tax bills that come in July, the tax laws amendment bill and the tax administration laws amendment bill. So those will still come in July. So this bill at the moment is in a draft form, because we produce these bills as draft bills just to try and deal with the procedure to amend money bills, and therefore they're not tabled. So you will not find them on any formal parliamentary tabling. It's only been put on the website and distributed to the committee. Once, of course, the committee has had hearings, we will then proceed to table it formally. I should add that there were other measures related to the carbon tax bill. There is a separate process, and all of these bills are draft bills and not tabled. So, Chair, if you want to just get to, do you want to just go through, why don't you just talk through the slide first before we get to the other issues?
Thank you very much. Morning. There was 75 confirmed reports. We'll just go through them quickly again, just to give the context. But as Norman was saying, we had a very serious shortfall last year. So, I mean, things were quite dire. We thought we were going to be about 48.2 billion. In the budget, we showed that about 21 billion of that, in that little chart there, was from personal income taxes. That was our shortfall just on personal income taxes, about 13.7 on net VAT, 5.2 on dividend withholding tax, 3.6. There were basically no revenue items which we were outperforming. So there was a very difficult fiscal position that we were in, and we needed to make some large tax changes to be able to right the ship in a way. The unaudited outcome, which was announced in the media statement by SARS, is about 700 million worse than what was expected at budget. So it's about 48.9 billion dollars. And those audit figures will be.
I think that's an important point, Chair, just to note to members, because obviously at the time of the budget, that was still a projection. Now, as we speak, it's at least we know the quantum of what was collected or what wasn't collected.
Only slightly worse. So the tax proposals were required to raise around 36 billion rand for 2018-19, which is really to help reduce the budget deficit, which will help to pay for social programs such as the higher education. So the main proposals which are included in this draft rate bill either 1 percentage point increase in VAT from 14% to 15%. Limited relief for bracket fees for personal income tax, for the bottom three personal income tax brackets, and we didn't provide any relief on the top four brackets, so those changes on the personal income tax system is in this rate book. And the increase in the ad valorem excise duty rate on luxury goods from 7% to 9%, as well as a higher cap on motor vehicles from 25% to 30%, a higher estate duty tax rate of 25% for estates greater than 30 million, a 22 cents per litre increase in the general fuel levy, a 30 cents per litre increase in the RAS levy, and increases in the excise duties on alcoholic beverages and tobacco products, which is 6 and 10%. So those are the main rate changes that we've done in budget, and most of those are effective already and are in the last rate call. So just to see how much revenue we got from all these items, we do publish a table in the budget review, which is quite excellent. So you can see the largest revenue change there is the 22.9 billion increase in the value added tax rate. The second largest is the personal income tax, which increases 6.8 billion for not fully adjusted for inflation. And then there's some smaller other items. The fuel levy increased there with 1.2. Members should remember that the RAS levy increase of 30 cents per litre doesn't go into the National Revenue Fund, it goes straight to the Road Accident Fund, so it wouldn't be included in this table. The ad valorem excise duty, those luxury goods that we increased the tax on, would make about a billion. And the introduction of the health promotion levy, the sugary beverage tax, hopefully will make about 1.9, because that will become effective on 1 April.
Just to focus on this, I mean, and just for members, if we want to raise a large amount of revenue, we have three big taxes, basically personal income tax, corporate income tax, and VAT, and they raise just over 80% of all our tax revenue. So given the quantum, it's really not possible for us to raise that amount by not touching any of the big three. To the extent that we then have to focus on personal income tax, I think we need to remember that 3 years ago we increased it by 1% for all but the lowest bracket. We also last year increased the top bracket to 45%. It doesn't yield too much revenue, it raised about 4.4 billion. And so in a sense, because we had already exhausted personal income tax, there wasn't much scope to increase it again, because on the one hand, it didn't raise the revenue that we projected in the last fiscal year. Well, one big reason for the gap was the under-collection on personal income tax, which is $21 billion. Okay. With regard to corporate tax, it's just given that internationally it's going the other way. In the US, it had its major tax proposals. They brought down their corporate income tax to 21% from 35%. The UK is, 19%. So, you know, just from a competitiveness perspective, it's not easy to increase that tax. It will have huge impacts on corporates, on jobs, and so on. However, having said that, I think we should bear in mind we did increase the dividends tax last year, and of course we do have the carbon tax, which will also fall on corporates. So corporates will be taxed through other ways, but that did leave us with little option but to consider VAT, which does bring in 23 billion. And I think that's going to be the important point. So the rates bill is not only about VAT, it's about all these other taxes, because to the extent that on personal income tax that we didn't change the top three thresholds, through fiscal drag or through inflation, it actually does raise 6.8 billion rands. We did exercise the personal income tax option, but for the big amount, we needed VATS. I just thought that context is important just to bear in mind. Okay.
Thanks. So the slide is on the race ball itself. So I think Moma has gone through the process of the race ball and how it comes into effect. This slide is trying to back up Moma's point just to show that top line shows the increase in the contribution of personal income tax to our total tax revenue. So it's increased quite dramatically from 2007, where it was below 37%, up to 37% last year. And a lot of that increase is due to tax policy changes that we have made. So we, as Mama said, we did a 1 percentage point increase between 2014-15, we did a 4 percentage point increase in the top bracket, 45% in 2016-17, and then in 2017-18, we gave very little relief for inflation, as well as giving very little relief for inflation in 2014-16-17. It does show that we have increased it a lot, and we've been getting consecutive shortfall in this revenue item. So even though we've been increasing taxes, we're making less and less from this personal income tax revenue source. We have also made other changes which we think makes the system quite progressive and has helped with the personal income tax line. So we moved from a medical tax deduction to a medical tax credit, which means that if you make contributions to medical aid, we now give those on lower incomes more of a benefit, and we've taken away a lot of the benefit to those on higher income, so you get the same amount for everybody regardless of your income. We've limited the deduction that you can make to retirement fund contributions at $350,000, so a lot of very wealthy or higher income individuals could contribute more than that and end up paying less tax, so we put a cap on that. And we've also increased the effective capital gain tax rate from 10 to 18% over the last 5 years or so. So we've made big increases in not only the personal income tax table, but in the other types of taxes related to personal income, which have increased the progressivity over these years. So the scope for substantial revenues from the top are also quite limited. So the first port of call, people say, well, why didn't you increase taxes right at the top? So we did do that. We had a new 45% rate, but it's not going to bring in enough money. So the 45%, as Moma mentioned, should bring in about $4.4 billion. But we needed to raise $56 billion. You're not going to be able to get the money you need from only increasing the rates right at the top. The problem is a lot of those individuals are able to increase their avoidance or evasion. They can hire smart tax policy advisors to try and get around and do that. And we don't see the returns that we need. There also could be real impact on work ethic or economic activity, which does worry us in terms of the impact that that would have on economic growth. So what does the budget 2018 propose? This is to show the difference between the two tables from 1 year to the next. In the green boxes, you can see that's where we've given quite a bit of relief. So we gave 2.1% increase in the bracket, so the bottom four brackets. So we did give some inflation relief. And we gave a 2.9% increase in the tax-free threshold. So you can see the tax-free threshold went up from 75,000 up to 78,000. So we have given some relief there. But we didn't give any relief on the top bracket. So if you, the bracket that's from 555,000 and upwards, we didn't change those at all. So we haven't given any inflation relief for the high income individuals. This rate will also include the medical tax credit adjustment that was below inflation. So we've increased the medical tax credit amount from 303 rand per beneficiary, the first two beneficiaries per month, to 310 rand. And then for your third and more beneficiaries, we've increased it from 204 rand to 209 rand. So regardless of your income, everybody who contributes to medical aid will get that amount as a credit. So it is a below inflation increase, and our forecast we assume a full inflation increase. So in effect, the government then makes additional revenue. So we think we'll make about 700 million in additional revenue in 2018-19. This will be, in effect, soft earmarked, and will be provided to for expansion in the NHI program. So that money will be soft earmarked. It will directly go to the Department of Health for an expansion in NHI. We've also committed to do this for the next 2 years. So for the next 2 years, there will also be below inflation increases in the medical tax credit, and the revenue we make from that will go to NHI funding. That table just shows that alongside our MTBPS box, we did a box there to show the impact of the medical tax credit. By shaving it off, it does actually hit quite a few individuals on lower income. A lot of lower income individuals below 350,000 rand a year. do contribute to the medical aid and are making use of this benefit. So it is, we are worried about the progressive nature of this change in this entirety. It is also just to note that this is for a small expansion in the NHI. This is certainly not to expand the NHI in its entirety. That would be another debate. Umpo, will you talk about the VAT changes?
Good morning, honorable members. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Just to discuss the issue around that. As this moment has indicated, we have the three tax instruments that raise over 80% of the tax revenue. And among those, that is the most efficient and certain source of revenue in terms of that. And the increase of the VAT rate was found to be the least detrimental in terms of the economic growth and employment, which the country really needs at this point. And as everybody knows, that the VAT rate was last adjusted in 1993. So, looking at the amount of revenue that was needed, that's why we took that issue around increasing the rate on that. Now, the issues that were raised with regards to having some sort of a month of register system where basically you have a component in the and there's some web that people have done earlier in the past where the test commission looked at the issue around the Qatar VAT to just indicate that the introduction of a month of that way basically would outweigh or not the benefit that in case of to derive from having a multiple resources. Again, we are looking at the work that was done by the Service Tax Committee to look at the multiple rate, that rate. To say again, the issue around the complexity of the system of the multiple rate that would bring to bear in terms of the revenue administration would be quite significant. And then again, that we have the currently in terms of the tax system, we have ad valorem excise that deals with lateral goods.
So, Chair, I know the Davis Tax Committee is coming, but I don't know if members have seen their report on VAT. They do publish a number of reports. They haven't really had an opportunity, I think, more recently. I know they've been to Parliament, but to talk through some of their papers. So this was done in 2015, but let the judge, when he comes, actually talk through it. But we're just giving you just those key points that I think emerge in their report.
Thanks, Mom. And then, as the Chris has indicated, part of the revenue proposal that was included in the budget was the increase on the ad valorem. This is currently the system from 7% to 9%, and also increasing the motor vehicle ad valorem cap from 5% to 50%, just to make sure that the luxury or component of it, the high end. The next slide just shows some of the items that are included on the actual website. Maybe to indicate that over time, because this is a list of actual websites, over time there's quite a number of items that have been excluded from or eliminated from the list. So again, over time, what was luxury way back then might not be a luxury today. So a number of items have been eliminated over time. And just maybe to emphasize the point, again, even if you were to increase the rate significantly, because you are dealing with a limited number of items, from a revenue raising point of view, we are not going to be able to raise significant revenue from that because we have a very limited list of this level of items. In the next slide, just looking at the issue around the zero rating that is currently there in the VAT system, where you have the 19 basic food items and also have paraffin. That is the rate. Those 19 items, when they were introduced, were basically to provide relief to poor households when that was introduced. And there have been some studies that have been published around the impact of those zero ratings in terms of the perceived regressivity of the health system. And to say that the 19 food items provide that there will be basically reduces the regressivity of the health system. And the increase in that, we acknowledge that it will increase the cost of living for all households. And the discussions about whether the current 19 food items of the health basket, whether it provides sufficient relief for households, considering that this basket was introduced over 3 years ago, whether there needs to be, I think, it will be part of the discussion that will come. And with regards to that, I think maybe Momo can talk about the issue about the independent panel of experts to look at the very same issue around the zero rating space.
So, Chair, the Minister had announced the establishment of this panel after discussion with Judge Davis. So it's been done under the auspices of the Davis Tax Committee. It will be chaired by Professor Ingrid Woolard. We released the names. The Minister had made the announcement on the 29th. We had to then obviously check with them, or Ms. Woolard had to check with all the potential members that she helped to identify, and this was all finalized towards the end of last week, and yesterday we just produced the terms of reference and the panel. So what they'll do is they'll evaluate whether the current list of 19 zero-rated food items achieves the objectives for which it was implemented, including the consumption patterns of low-income households. In other words, they'll look at whether it's still relevant for poor households. I think the point was made during the hearings that some items may not be as focused on low-income households as was perhaps the case initially. But they would also consider, I think whilst they're focused, they would also focus on the broad categories. So, for example, there is a category, as was discussed in the fiscal framework hearings, of fruit. But does that mean all, you know, zero rating should apply to all fruit? Because you find that low-income households tend to focus on a few of the fruits, like apples, oranges, bananas. Kiwi fruit is not there, for example. So they would look at that list. But they'll also look at sort of any other food items, just by looking at recent household surveys or the income expenditure surveys. And they would also look at, they would obviously have to look at, while the focus will be on food, they will look at non-food items, obviously within the framework of consumption by poor households. We've listed some of the bullet points there which just indicate the factors that they would have to take into account. I should add, Chair, an important factor is going to be that they stay within the fiscal framework, because there are items, for example, that, you know, if you include X, if it brings a shortfall of 5 billion rands, what's that going to be replaced by? I think that's going to be the critical issue to look at. But we've left it to the panel to make that assessment. So I think I've dealt with, there you have the list, Mr. Ibonga Kawa, Professor Ada Janssen, Dr. Tabi Lyoka, Niva Muketla, Lynn Mueng from the Department of Health, one Cecil Morden, who I don't know, and from SAMS, Mr. Prinesh Rampal, and Professor Imran Balodia from BITS. I think, Chair, you had asked at the start, what have we done since the last meeting? Since the last meeting, there's not been that much time. There's been lots of public holidays. We tried to have one meeting, which really didn't suit many of the organizations. So we went ahead. I think only two were able to attend. But we did say that we'd have further meetings, and which we will be in the process of setting up. I should add, Chair, that when we have those meetings, we are obviously looking to go through the inputs that were presented to Parliament to the extent that there's more sort of research done by those institutions. We would also look at that or concerns that they have. And in parallel, there is the process for the panel. So we're going to have to just see how the Treasury deals with these institutions directly, whilst at the same time we're hoping they will participate in the process with the panel. The panel itself is not only going to take submissions, but it's going to also have hearings, and it will provide more details, I think, once they're able to meet.
Okay, and then just lastly, just on the general fuel levy, I mean, this is just to show that the 22 cents per litre increase gave us about 1.2 billion. If we had increased by inflation, the fuel levy, general fuel levy would have gone up by about 17 cents a litre. We wouldn't have made any additional revenue. That would have been just assumed. And the road accident fund went up by quite a large 30 cents per litre. So the price at about R5.34 on every litre of petrol, pump price is about 13.90, and on diesel is about R5.19 in taxes. Slightly below 40 cents on petrol and just about 41 on diesel.
I think, as you indicated, the rate bill does not only deal with rent increases, it also deals with other increases. So this is a clause by clause of the provisions in the rate bill. And the first one deals with introducing a higher estate duty of 25% for estate above 8 million. Clause 2 deals with fixing of normal rates. Clause 3 deals with increasing rebates, primary, secondary, and tertiary rebates. Okay. Clause 4 deals with increase in medical tax credits. And Clause 5 introduces a higher donations tax. This is a consequential as a result of increasing in estate duty of 25% to estate above 30 million. So as to avoid any tax structuring, we increase the donations tax of, we introduce a higher rate of 25% for donations over 30 million. And Clause 6, we adjust the formula for residential accommodation. And Clause 7 deals with the amendment in the Customs and Excise Act based on the increases in the customs and excise duties. Clause 8 is the big one, increase the value-added tax rate from 14 to 15%. And Clause 9, remember during the budget day we also published the draft regulation prescribing e-services for public comment, so we have to make consequential amendments in the VAT Act for that. And Clause 10 also deals with those consequential amendments. And Clause 11 also deals with those consequential amendments for e-services. And Clause 12, remember last year there was the whole issue of whole wheat brown bread when Department of Agriculture changed the regulation. It also deals with that. That Clause 12 deals with that issue. It should be noted that when we published the rate bill on the 21st of February, and then there were commentators whereby because of the bread rate increase in Section 7, there are other consequential amendments, for instance, in Section 8.27 of the VAT Act and Section 66, whereby it also refers to 14% and the formula. So we have to update those, we have to do those consequential amendments in the rate bill as well. So there was an updated rate bill in the 9th of March, but now because we are dealing with the rate bill that was published on 21st February, we are dealing with that. But we will update based on the amendments and also on the input by the have practitioners regarding consequential amendments. It's not a policy change, consequential amendments.
All right, can we quickly move on? Just to explain, the aim of this briefing was to give us an overview of the bill. It's not to engage exhaustively with the clauses, right? The main aim is to hear the public. It's a public hearing. Now, the initial idea was to have this yesterday. Unfortunately, the committee from the SUP was not available. So, I know Judge Dennis Davis has to be back in the court. He has to leave at 10 to 11. Let's take that into account as well. I'm just saying there's no point exhaustively engaging with the issues. It's just to give us a feel and also to let the public what is really in the book in case there's a need for that. Right, Mr. Mania.
Thank you, Chair. I've got three brief questions, but I think it's appropriate to point out that we would not be in this position where government was raising revenue, especially revenue through VAT, had it not been for the low levels of economic growth because of the mismanagement of the economy, failure to contain expenditure. I know the truth hurts, Eunice, but it's incumbent on the opposition.
No, I can't agree with some of what you're saying.
Yeah, what reason why?
First, we agree with some of what you're saying. But it's simple on the court.
Yeah. Which aspects do you agree?
Right, fine. Could you quickly raise some issues beyond what you normally say?
The first point is, did National Treasury conduct a fiscal impact study prior to making proposals to raise the revenue? And if it did, is that study contained in a report? And if it is contained in a report, what is that title of that report, and will you please provide us with a copy of that report? First question. Second question is, in your estimates, you estimate that a 1% increase in VAT will raise an additional 22.9 million rand in revenue. On what basis do you make that estimate? Because that estimate is a significantly higher than most estimates of reliable, if you like, market participants in the industry. It seems to be a significantly higher. That's the second question. The third question is, to what extent did the Moody's rate play, to what extent was that a factor in your decision to increase VAT? Specifically, was there a discussion with Moody's Investor Services prior to the budget, and was the Moody's Investor Services and their rating a factor in your decision to specifically increase VAT?
Thank you. Okay. Any other quick questions of clarity, please? Tony?
Chad, I don't even know why you
I
can't.
So
this has nothing to do with the rate field.
Now he's asking a question about the impact study, that's correct.
Right.
Tell me, I can do nothing, don't change the rules.
Right. Okay, I'm a bit disappointed that much has not been done since our last meeting. One of the things that I thought we were going to apply our minds here was on medical credit, for instance. Because we're trying to look at all things, just dating is the only question.
So what?
No, then I want to engage you.
So what? It's supposed to be here. It's his job.
So, I thought we were going to apply our minds on the medical credit. Second, I'm interested to know at what rate will the rebate be increased, especially in education. Because I want to juxtapose this to the changes that it will make in terms of how the consequential amendments are going to make an impact into the industry. And lastly, in terms of the donation tax, in the past, it has not necessarily been a good result. So I want to know, is there going to be an impact in the current conjuncture to give us some form of collections that we can rely on? And maybe we should have a schedule that tells us about what the increase in tobacco and alcohol is going to give us in statistics. So when we deal with it, we can be able to explain it in different terms
can we give pretty quick replies? Remember, Momo, you've got 8 minutes, right? Because the judge has to take over, and then we can come back to you. Because you will be with us all the time, very quickly.
Okay, Chair. No, we don't do formal statements. I mean, every workforce, by degree, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of modeling going to and fro between certainly ourselves, staff, others. We have committees that meet. The revenue analysis working committee. We've presented all of, you know, those results in our response documents, for example. So, and the budget review does contain, I think, a lot of that work. There's no formal papers. I think, Chair, and that gets to, you know, what's the impact on the economy and so on. Obviously, you know, it's not because any ratings agency tells us that we have to do X, Y, Z. We don't discuss with them beforehand. They were certainly out to watch to what extent are we going to stabilize our debt. You can decide to lift your expenditure as high as you like, but then make sure that you're going to raise the revenue for it. Obviously, the share of expenditure or taxation in the economy may have some impact on growth. They look at growth. So they look at all those factors. To the extent that we had the gap, it was out in the MTBPS, adjusted for the higher education allocations, for example. And to the extent that we saw the revenue gap, we had no choice but to fill the gap to try and stabilize the debt to GDP. I think that metric was the critical metric to actually deal with. Of course, I mean, if one compares to previous years, generally the trend for the big taxes has been to lower the rates as and when we could. But obviously we were faced in recent times where that wasn't the case and we had to increase taxes quite significantly over the last few years. The best way to get out of that is to start stimulating growth into the economy, and I think that's the kind of discussion we need. But to get to growth, we've got to make sure that we at least preserve our investment rating and hence, that was an important factor that we looked at, one of the many factors we looked at, including looking at factors like how do you get delivery on the ground, be it for higher education, be it for schooling, etc. With regard to our estimate on, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, so I mean, it's not that. I mean, we didn't think it was that outlandish at all. I mean, we worked together with our economic policy units at the National Treasury. We had their growth projections in the budget included our tax impact on the economy, so we do try and incorporate the tax impact that flows back into the economy. I mean, some of the estimates I saw around 22 billion, we were 22.9, so we were slightly higher, but it might have been because of the different growth forecasts within the EP going forward. And then on the other question, Younger, on the donation tax, I'm not sure, but the tobacco and alcohol one, we publish in the People's Guide exactly what the impact is per beer and per pack of cigarettes, so we can get those for you. And the donation tax, we haven't got an estimate on the revenue for that, but it's one of those things where we've got an estimate, I think, of 150 million for the higher estate duty, but if we didn't put the donation tax in, that estimate for the higher estate duty would have gone closer to zero, because then people can try to go around it. Hopefully that satisfies. I wasn't quite sure the question on the labour tax credits.
I was saying that I thought that you could have worked out around how you can provide information and make sure you can cut. It's one issue that you look at in your previous. There are those who believe you need to focus on it. So I thought maybe you need to prepare something on the slide. So it didn't reflect anything except the way you summarize the conversation.
Thank you. I think we need to focus more on the rate increase. When we do the response, can you prepare the
interview? Can we just move on quickly? Some observations. One is, Momo, not now, isn't the time, right? It's not clear why you don't do an impact study, given the gravity of the VAT increase. It is surprising, but maybe I'm wrong. You do an impact study, but you're saying you've got scattered information. And so if you have such a thing, he's right. You must tell me what rule I can prohibit him. Now, just Venezuelans, can I prevent in a multi-party democracy, which she fought for, the right of this person, as much as he might say some heinous thing, and he's mobilized people from Khayelitsha there, right? It's his right. Now, I can't change the rules, right? So it's his right. Didn't you ask any questions? I'm not the judicial judge. So, no, right. So there you are. Right, this is the judge who's got to be. Take him on, intellectually and politically. Yeah, well, he's got a very certain mind. What do I do about that? He's the DA shadow minister. Right. And that's a factual empirical observation. It's not a point of view. Glenn, I'm cheating, right? In case you're getting upset. Although I'm more serious than you think I am. Even if less serious than I'm making out to be. Right, here we are. Firstly, can we discuss this issue? What do you mean? Because you didn't answer your question. If you have such a study, call it an impact study or whatever, or the implications of being, why can't we have it? What constitutional prohibition is this official justice that is offline? Secondly, what is worrying me, comrades and colleagues? Can we please note the standing? Stop harassing that young man. Look, 30th of June. Yeah, well, you stop harassing that young woman. Can I just raise the thing? You know what's worrying me, Momo, colleagues? If you look at our program, we are running a parallel process to the independent panel, which is going to consult the same set of stakeholders, and secondly, your consultation process, right? So I think we'll have to think this thing through. Can you give the chairs a bit of a mandate to look at our program again and see how we go? The thing I want to stress is what Tandy is saying, Momo. Look, firstly, I am very empathetic. As a chair of a committee, of both chairs, we know most than, as chairs would, not because of any great insight, because of the roles we play. How hard you people work. We may disagree with you ideologically and policy-wise, really, Tandy, but they were very, very hard, okay? But the point is that it's still very worrying that only two people turned up, so we don't consider that a consultation. So when you send up your table of consultation, we're not going to take that seriously, right? So can we get from you within 10 days some sort of program, right, of your consultation, so that we can have a say? Secondly, Zakel and Antonia, or one of them, should be there, if need be one of the secretaries, if need be one of the chairs, right? Because this process is in Parliament now. But the capacity we have, given our standing workload, to send somebody, I'm looking at somebody in particular who's the ANC expert on tax, and the DA can send one person to, and the EFF, they can muster a person, because it's in the Parliament now, and we should be there. So, as we've done before, Zakir and Antonia, at least, they must account, and in fact, Frank, if he can go, but he's over, but so in short, can we talk offline about that? So, finally, Momo, this thing of using Trump and May. I mean, you know, they've been reducing taxes for business. I mean, they hardly good examples. We would rather you refer to developing countries or social democracy. I mean, Trump, I mean, really. So he reduced tax for what? Is that what he's there for? May, I mean, really. That's not a paradigm for the governing party, really. It's an ANC government. And really, Momo, this thing has to stop. Plus, we don't buy this thing, let me tell you. We are not experts, and we're not going to be taken by your table. That VAT comparatively, hey, this is a country that has the highest income inequalities and social inequalities in the world, the highest number of protests in the world, right? To tell us that, you know, this country, firstly, we can't check. We don't have the capacity. So the tables of yours, they're not credible to us as politicians. In an academic environment, you can go and tell those people, well, I'll repeat, once again, Tali, in an academic environment, you can go and tell people, you know what, VAT is not regressive. What's the word you guys use? Progressive. It's not regressive. Hey, the person, the people in Khayelitsha and Guguletu and Mitchell's Plain, they're not interested. When they've been going since the 1st of April, all these things that they buy. So, you know what, just like an academic exercise. So, I am so pleased, Momo. It's warm my heart that you didn't come here to argue, because then you're going to make us extremely angry, right? To say, no, you know, it's regressive because Professor so-and-so says this, and this left-wing professor, Imran Balogia, says, well, hey, you know what? They have a right to say it in the seminar. We are politicians here, right? So don't tell us. I know the professor's going to say it. He's right. He's going to say what he wants to say. But we are politicians here. This VAT increase is really worrying. So when I say judge, there is things that you want to do. Independent, and so you should be, right? You can tell us it's progressive, it's not regressive, you have to speak your mind. But we are talking to the department. And you must speak your mind, obviously. No one will stop you. Right? But I'm just saying, we're not interested in that. So Momo, and these tables, you know, you can use them, but they're not going to help. Right now, we are where we are. This is a very grave thing that happened, and we have to deal with it. Okay, Sandy, no, Sandy. If I say that your friend Mania is going to put his head up. No, you can come back, just tell us David. You agree with me? Yeah, we're ruling, right. So you can come back later. Just tell us David. What time do you have to leave, sir?
About an hour, which is what you wanted now.
You said you have to leave at 10 to 12.
No, I need
12 o'clock. Okay, so you 2 minutes, we owe you 2 minutes, so 2 minutes past 12 you can leave.
Yeah.
Can you take 50% of the time, 30 minutes then, to speak, and in 30 minutes, we'll start with time and have good friend Mr. Mania.
Yeah,
fine. Okay.
You want me to just make a few comments myself,
the
chair, and then...
Yeah, you can say whatever. Okay. The point is, we ask you to speak about your work, your independent technical work on VAT, but we also said if you feel it's appropriate for you to comment on the current VAT, if it's appropriate, we don't know, do so. And you can say anything you want.
I think it's
never mind what Sandy said.
I think it is appropriate because I think that's just the context, because Momo and I have worked together with these colleagues for a number of years now, since we became the DTC, over the crisis, and there's been a crisis for some years that we all know about how we can match expenditure with revenue. We have been in the unusual situation, Chair, of not just having to give long-term advice, but every year we've been asked, well, what should we do for this budget? And therefore, yes, I will comment on that particular context. But perhaps let me start with the following. The context, which you've obviously got from Treasury, which is utterly correct, is we, every year when we've had a difficulty of how do we raise some additional funds in order to plug the gap. And I think the most significant single figure on the budget is 180 billion. And that's the interest cost. Because whether we can stand on our heads or not, it means that 12 cents in every rand that every South African spends, tax, goes to interest on debt, which means we're crowding out the necessary expenditure that we require. And so obviously when you get to the budget, you've got the anxiety of that particular figure keeps on going up. You have less money for social grants, less money for education, etc., etc. So the question over the years has been how to deal with that. And obviously, until this year, that has been a holy grail. We didn't want to go there. And we've tried all sorts of things, and I'm not going to waste the committee time, they know that it was weird, in order to get around the problem. I think it's fair to say that the context in which we faced ourselves this year has a twofold one. I'm not persuaded that the 48 billion shortfall was purely as a result of a downturn in the economy. And I'd like to offer two other aspects to that, which I think are relevant, and they're relevant going forward. The one is, clearly tax morality is declining. I can only tell you that anecdotally, but I can tell you that when I've spoken to all sorts of people as to why our special voluntary disclosure program does not bring in as much money from the people who secreted money offshore, given the fact that there's the Panama Papers and the HSBC disclosures, and all of the possibilities of cooperation between revenue authorities around the world to find these people, and we probably got, what, 3, 4 billion, I think it's 3, 4 billion, which I thought was very low compared to Argentina and Indonesia, which were hopelessly oversubscribed for similar situations given the context. Consistently, I've been told by people, our clients are not prepared to disclose. Why, say I? Oh, two reasons. One is they'll never be found out, and two, they steal. You know, the usual proverbial, they steal. Now, as distasteful as that is, it indicates to me a decline in tax morality, and I'm sure that's a factor. The second is, you can do a back of a cigarette box calculation and ask yourself when revenue projected what they were going to collect in the previous budget on the growth rate. And you minus that from the, you take off the real growth rate from that growth rate, around 0.5% of GDP, and you multiply that by the percentage of tax to GDP that we use, it works out that of the 48 billion, about 24, 25 is accountable by a lack of growth, and the rest must be, the explanation must be found elsewhere. And I am suggesting that the President was entirely correct in his speech with respect earlier this year when he opened Parliament to suggest that part of the problem must lie with science. And that's what we inherited. And on top of that, we inherited the increase in tertiary education. Now, we can talk about the morality of that, but that added to the burden, whether you like it or not, because you had to add additional money. So the question is, where are you going to get it from? To ask, to say, the question is, which tax? We'd run out of road. If you ask yourself, where can you tax? If you increase personal income tax from 45 to 50%, you get roughly about 4 to 5 billion additional. And I'm not sure you're going to get all of that in. I'm not a believer in the Laffer curve, which indicates that the higher your rates, the less you collect. But it is interesting to me that there was a significant decline in personal income tax when we put it up from 23 to 45 in the high end. And whilst I'm prepared to accept that that's part of tax morality, perhaps attributable to less increases than we thought, and the SARS problem, it may well indicate that there are thresholds beyond which you go that you actually don't become very productive in tax collection. I just raised the point. So the question is, if you can't do that, where else do you go? We could. Now, I hear what you say, Chair, about what I think was a corporate tax problem, which is, well, we shouldn't be following Mr. Trump. I accept we shouldn't be following Mr. Trump on anything. The only thing I can say on the side, I've just been in the United States, and I feel as a South African a sense of extraordinary moral superiority when I compare our president to their president. It makes me feel very good. But the point I'm making is, in the African societies, African countries are also considering, and in many cases are decreasing their corporate rates of tax, and they are our competitors for foreign capital, and that does worry me. So the question is, if you lower, you can't really lower, if you put higher, then you've got a problem that you're going to land up in a competitive world with other African countries for foreign capital, which, or even for local capital, which goes outside. And it is true that probably for a 2 or 3%, if we want to get 22 billion in, which is roughly 20.9, we probably would have had to increase the corporate tax between probably about 4%, which is very, very high and very significant. And then there is the issue of the impact, which Mr. Mania referred to. And Mr. Mania, in answer to you through the chair, well, you can go and read on our Davis tax reports, both the VAT report and the normative report, we reproduce a World Bank study that we commissioned and other studies which indicates the impact of increases of all taxes. And what you find there is this, that if you increase corporate tax, actually you contribute to a retardation of the growth rate in the short run and to increase of inflation to a greater extent than you do if you do that. That's what the economic evidence suggests. Meaning, if you had increased your corporate rate of tax by 3 or 4%, you would have pushed up inflation by a higher component than by a 1% VAT increase, and you most certainly would have reduced the growth rate by maybe up to 0.5%. Now, when you're only growing at 1.5%, frankly, that ain't a good idea. So that's a problem. Now, I'm not suggesting, these are political choices, not technical choices, but I'm giving you the technical answers, which is what we were supposed to do to the minister. So the question therefore arose, well, what other tactics are available? There was a suggestion at some that we should do a multiple VAT system. But I was persuaded by a treasury here that were we to do that, we would have had to change the act. Because you've got to ask yourself a question, what then becomes the luxury item? What they've done, and together with them we've done, is we look at all the ad valorem items. And then you kind of put, say, 17 or 18% on that, and you find you get less than a billion rand. Good enough. Really. And so the question is, how many items become luxury and how many items become ordinary? And it's a big problem, and if we did it this year, with respect to that, pass a new piece of legislation, and you wouldn't have been able to collect it immediately, and you would have then had a bigger problem with deficit. So it was that's the urgency, the urgency created that difficulty. And then, may I say one other thing, that what our evidence shows compellingly, and a really comprehensive study has been done, and it's all very well people telling me, oh, it was done by the IMF or the World Bank, but these are econometric studies, not back of the cigarette box stuff that I read consistently in the press. And what that shows me is that we have the most efficient VAT system in the world. In other words, if you test our nominal as opposed to the effective rate of VAT, that is what you'd expect to collect given our economic activity and what we do collect. It is unbelievably high. I was actually somewhat disappointed by that because I was hoping it would be lower than we could simply plug the gap there and I wouldn't have raised any taxes or advised the minister to raise any taxes. It's very, very good and reasonably very good because you have a few zero ratings and because you only have one rate. And therefore there's no arbitrage. See, if you have two rates, people start manipulating the output tax. So because there's a 16%, a 17%, a 14%, they start claiming 16% without any charging 14 creates havoc in the administration. That is an internationally empirically observed fact. So the question was whether to what was our advice? And it's I agree with you, Chair. Nobody in South Africa, when you've got a wealth Gini of 0.93, would want to recommend any tax increase which is going to affect poor people or exacerbate any level of inequality, whether income or wealth. The difficulty that we had here was where else to go. And I'll come back to the one other alternative that has been suggested, which is the wealth tax. But it is where else to go. Now, frankly, I think that the empirical evidence obviously is one thing, namely that it has most of the VAT is actually collected by welfare people. But it's true, you can't tell people in Khayelitsha, even if they're going to pay 200 or 300 rand a year more on that 1%, that most of it goes to welfare because it affects them. I accept that. And that's why what our independent panel wants to do, right, which we've coordinated with Treasury, is actually ask a series of very important questions in this regard. Let me just give you two instances. The one would be, should we now increase the span of zero ratings, and what should those be? We've had many suggestions. Brown bread, for example. Sanitary towels is another. There are a series of ones. You've got to ask yourself, what should be zero ratings? There is another overarching debate that we should have. We never do have, but we should have, which is whether zero rating is the most efficient way of getting the money back to poor people. I noticed that in the 2015 tax expenditure, which was in your budget review, the cost, I think, of the 19 rating item was about 23 billion. If you work that up, that 23 billion goes mainly to wealthy people, because we all buy the same goods. So the question is the most efficient way of getting 23 billion to poor people through zero ratings or through some other system? And I think we should talk about it. I don't have solutions to the problem, but let's have a national debate about what is the best way of getting the full amount, not half the amount, a quarter amount, the full amount to the people most in need. It's a serious, important question that needs to be answered, and we've never answered. I should say, just from the point of view of my position, I was Kasatu's representative in 1989. With Jay Naidoo and Bernie Fanaroff, and we argued against that. And then, of course, thanks to us, we got the 19 items. And I'm saying that in this vantage point, that we never really, it was very difficult to argue with the National Party on these issues because they were just going to do what they were going to do. But now that we've got a democratic government, it seems to me we should be having a democratic debate about what's the best way to ensure that the money that we give up goes to the people most in need of the money. And that's why I'm saying I'm not certain where that should be, but I'm just saying I'm putting that on the table. The other issue, Chair, that we thought about was the question of, let me say this about this independent panel. We would like to have that debate. And the way we do the debate, Chair, with the experts that have been announced, and Treasury has given us a range of the experts, which we're very grateful for. Ingrid Woolard, who's on my tax committee, will be chairing it, but I will certainly be playing a role in this regard too. We will have hearings, and we're going to invite everybody to come and talk to us. We do this all the time. We have hearings. Interestingly enough, when we had hearings on the wealth tax, we heard from the DA and we heard from the EFF, but we didn't hear from the ruling party. So we welcome the ruling party as well, and all parties and the trade unions to come and tell us to think through how can we actually ensure that the people in fact being affected by that in fact can be advantaged. How can we tweak the system to make it even better for them? That's really the object of this independent inquiry. Now, there has been some suggestion that we should have a significant wealth tax. We were very wrongly quoted in the press, and I wrote a letter to correct that. And let me just tell you something that is really relevant to everything. We are in favor of a wealth tax. Nobody in South Africa, who faced with a 0.93% wealth Gini, which is almost perfectly an equal society, should be against the wealth tax. Because, quite frankly, inequality is just, it's despicable. And I use that word advisedly. And therefore the question is, how to implement a wealth tax? But we found two things. Firstly, we found, what are you going to tax? Are you going to tax pension funds? We're much of the wealth has helped, including the PIC. Are you going to take 3 or 4% of whatever it is percent you're going to take of all their wealth? And how progressive is that? So we were ensured, that's the debate we've been inviting. We want to have that debate to discuss, should it be all pension funds, some pension funds, how does that work? The significant amount of wealth are within pension funds. Secondly, how do you define wealth? And thirdly, revenue have not got a full record of wealth in South Africa. That's why we've recommended immediately that the tax returns be recalibrated to ensure that full statements of assets be provided and the people do fiddle around, they should be prosecuted. The criminal law needs to be used now. If we can get the NPA right, the criminal law needs to be used now, because people should not be sitting in this country evading tax in the way they are. But once you've got all that data, once you've got all that information, then you can actually implement the wealth tax. And that's what we're recommending. Quickly, not slowly. That's why a couple of weeks, we didn't say South Africa was ready for it. We say we need to become ready for it. However, one of the issues that I do, I'm amused by, is the issue of estate duty. Estate duty is a wealth tax. No question. Now, I hear that it's only the increase of 30% is only doing roughly estimated, I think, 150 million. But I think that SARS needs to be, and I think we need to be much more ruthless about estate duty. There are too many holes by which people can avoid the statute. I should add and emphasize, I've just authored a judgment on behalf of four other judges of the Supreme Court of Appeal dealing with a preference share scheme, which has been used by many wealthy people, which will assist SARS enormously in future. Basically, and they should be auditing all of these people who've got these fancy schemes, which essentially peg the value of the state. But there is no reason why a statute of much higher than 30% at the higher levels. I would go up to 40% at the higher level, meaning I'm talking about 30, 40 million, whatever it is. And let's just pause for a moment. 30, 40 million in South Africa is a lot of money for the vast majority of people in this country. You know, when we made a recommendation check in relation to the state duty, the late Matthew Lester and I, that the first 15 million should be immune from estate duty. Everybody started screaming and saying, that's unfair. And we said, well, hang on, man. You die, and you leave your spouse a house for 5 million, an income of 10, which is a 6% rate of return, gives 600,000 rand a year. You know, that's a lot better than the vast majority of South Africans. So I would be strengthening estate duty immediately. It's an easy tax to administer. And but it won't bring in 22 billion. It may bring in 2, may bring in 3. It may be important, but it's important to understand that a wealth tax probably won't bring in much more than that either. The reason you want that tax is for legitimacy questions, and because it's right, and because people in the wealthier end should be paying more. So what I'm saying in summary, if you looked at where we were, when we gave advice we were trying to give advice which would marry efficiency with legitimacy. We do think, by the way, as well, that I accept that corporate taxes that seem to not, as it were, hit the radar, and we haven't really given proper advice on this, but I want to put them on the table, are excise taxes and petrol levies. I never quite understand why we've had this huge debate about that for years, and every time we put up the petrol price, nobody says a word.
Yeah.
But actually, strangely enough, that's a retrogressive tax, probably even more so than, in fact, definitely more so than that. So, you know, let's get real here and start thinking. If we could actually get 3 or 4 billion rand in on estate duty, which I really believe if we just amended certain sections and started taking the thing seriously, you know, I'd rather have less on the fuel levy and more on that. That becomes a much more sensible system. So, but what I'm putting to the committee is that what we found was we are so much a captive of the skewed wealth system of apartheid South Africa that 20 odd years after democracy, we're still in that problem. I mean, we only have 109,000 taxpayers on the books who are at 1.5 million rand or more. By the way, I'm not convinced that that is an accurate figure. I'm sorry, I said this before, and I know Mr. Mayanga pretty cross with me for suggesting that I know more people who earn 500 million rand at the Johannesburg bar than I do on the books. It was supposed to be a joke, but what it was supposed to illustrate was that I think there are that we've got a much larger level of tax evasion here than meets the eye. But I can't be sure about that. But that's why the SAR strengthening becomes so important. So in summation, for the year 2018, I'm not sure there were many options available just for the reasons which we've given. As I say, you go through the impact study and you look at where the impact is on the economy, and the least worst impact was VAT. They're all bad. And therefore what we've got to do now through our advice to the minister and to you, through the independent panel, is to try to ensure that that's alleviated to the largest degree. We do want to actually strengthen the tax as well. We do want to ensure that people are prosecuted properly, because they've had enough opportunities to come in for the disclosure program. I mean, there were, 1,700 South Africans on the Panama Papers alone. Now, I accept that some of those may be legal. I don't know who's legal and isn't. But the fact is, there are clearly a hell of a lot of people living in this country paying absolutely no tax with vast wealth outside the country. And that's just not acceptable. And even if that's going to bring us 3, 4, 5 years in annuity income. So all of this matters. And then finally, what I want to suggest is that one of the things we need to think about, even this year, is what happens next year. Because the one thing we can be sure about is we can't increase that again. And so the issue becomes so crucial that we've got to get growth up, we've got to get revenue that solves right? Because if we don't, where are we going to get another 36 billion from? And the short answer to that is we ain't. And we need to understand that. So, Deputy Director General can look at me quickly, but if he comes to me next year and says, where am I going to find another 36 billion? So he can't get it from that. The personal income tax, he may get 5, maybe 7, but who knows? I'm not concerned about whether people leave the country. I'm not going to buy that argument. I'm sure you're going to get that from some people. Or if you put up the marginal rate to 55%, they all leave. Well, let them go, as far as I'm concerned. But generally, the people, my sense is, those people are people who are not paying the right amount anyway. What I am saying is that if you follow Anthony Atkinson, more than Piketty, there is a justification for higher marginal rates on equity and other grounds. But what I am suggesting is for this year, if we were looking for 30-odd, it wasn't, in a sense, there. And that was why that was the only option available, as regrettable as it is. And that's why what I'm inviting people is, if we get the advice right on the independent panel, we could do some really creative things. And we need to think creatively for the one objective, to ensure that all of the money that we pay in zero ratings goes to the people most in need. So, Chair, that's broad my comments, and I'd be much more willing to answer all, any questions, comments.
25 minutes, right, over to men. Can we suspend questions to National Treasury from now? We'll come back to the end on that. On Judge Dennis, there's the input, Tandy. And Okis, you wanted to ask.
Chair,
Gwen,
Chair, let me say it up front. The ANC has been vindicated. We might have not approached the Judge Davis to speak about the wealth tax, but the ANC has been calling for a wealth tax. It has been the ANC that has been calling for that, and it has been the DA that does not want the wealth tax. So it's good that they went to make a submission and you give them a justification for a wealth tax. Also, we need to say upfront, the ANC that spoke about the voluntary disclosure program, and we were the ones who reported in the chamber about how much we were able to collect and what we can be able to collect if there's more information sharing in relation to people who are not only involved in the Panama Papers, but in the Paradise Papers, as they were tabled before. So we've been calling for a heightened engagement internationally in relation to that. But first, before I come to questions, let me also speak to this, because it's very important why this matter was juxtaposed about Trump, you see, so that the chairperson also understands. You see, the America, in terms of dealing with outflows, they decide to lock out certain investors, particularly from Asia, to make sure that they secure their own environment. And it's very important to understand that. I don't think Momo juxtaposed it just for this. And I spoke about it when I debated on the budget in the chamber, because it's very important to understand what they are trying to do. And we're not saying we should be taking that route either, because to us, investment becomes a very important tool to generate our income. But equally, we're not going to debate whether in relation to withholding of refunds by SARS, we were able to deal with issues. In principle, we agree with certain things. Some were very difficult for us to relate in the immediate. But the issue at hand was why there was a need to have a VAT increase. And that's where I thought you were going to say to us, based on the 22.9 shortfall that needed to be collected in the immediate, this has to be the approach. We were the ones in the ANC, not the DA, who said in this meeting it should be in the short term. So that's an agreement. We said in our report we're going to make it clear that it's not going to be rolled over in the next fiscal year. So in the outer years it's not a focus, because we understood that we needed to plug the gap that is there in the immediate. Now, you raise a fundamental issue which we need to consider, and that's why when I was speaking to them earlier, I said, have you considered other things, including the mid-term tax credit, so that we can see in total, when we deal with ad valorem, how can we increase what is collected through them? It's because we're trying to have a balancing act to see that as and when, because the implementation of the wealth tax is not going to be in the immediate. It's going to take another fiscal framework for you to be able to put it up, for you to collect enough that can close. What is going to be another gap comes next fiscal year. So it's on those bases that we said, let's relook the list of the zero-rated items to make sure that in the immediate, including social programs, that will make sure that what is collected is re-injected into social services for it to alleviate the challenge that those, the poor people, will be experiencing. So we said, that's why I was disappointed, because I wanted a suggestion that says, in terms of social services, this is how we're going to refund it back to the poor. Not only through the SASA announcement that has been made because they are there, but in other programs that we're going to have in place that is going to make sure that the poor benefit directly from them. And this is one thing for you guys must bring to us before we even finalize this. Because we said the very rich people benefit directly from zero rating. We said that after. Now, one of the fundamental issues that needs to also be attended to, and the question I'm throwing it back to you, in terms of how do you mobilize foreign capital and local capital in the immediate. It's one thing that you might have not responded to in the immediate, but when engagement starts, we might want to look at that. Secondly, we're going to need suggestions that's going to speak to the SA duty. Because in the current conjuncture, in terms of how it's structured, not all properties, or how can I put it in simple English, are necessarily required in the Republic for you to do the necessary assessment, for you to be able to realize the wealth tax. So it's going to be a cumbersome process to even try to assess the wealthiness of an individual in terms of how they structured their properties and how they hidden them in different jurisdictions. And I've asked this question before, Yanga, if you remember, that do we have a record of the asset base of South Africans, not necessarily within the Republic, but outside, for us to be able to really look at this? We have to answer.
Sir, do I take more time, or should I come back again?
those reasons why. And to continuously come up with policies that just cover up the problem is not really a sustainable way moving forward. And so that's the first point, is that I think we need to start actually addressing the underlying issues here and start avoiding the environment by just addressing the outcome, which is we have inequality, we have a deficit, so why? And yes, you might say, look, in the short term, we can't do anything about that, we are where we are, but I still think we need to look in the long term what we do about this, otherwise, a few years later, we're having the same discussions all over again, because we thought it was inconvenient to have a discussion about how we got here. The second point to make is that, you know, government has to make a commensurate contribution or effort here. So you're asking in either way for the public to feel a bit of pain. Either you're asking for those who are wealthy to feel a bit of pain, or in the case of that, perhaps a co-factor, but you're asking somebody to feel a bit of pain to justify the failures of the past administration. And I think in the excesses that Vivian often pointed out, it's not to say that there isn't necessarily enough money to be raised by cutting from those various areas. But I think it's so important that even a show of goodwill that commensurate to any public pain that is expected to be felt, government comes to the table and says, this is the pain we're prepared to deal. Because actually there are a lot of areas that raise not insignificant amounts of money. Quite recently, the South Institute of Race Relations released a report highlighting the expenditure that goes towards VIP and protection services, around 2.6 billion rand every single year. Now, look, it doesn't cover the amount of the shortfall that needs to be raised, but you're putting 0.7 billion towards an NHI of 700 million rand. How does your commitment to a public healthcare system compare towards your commitment to protecting, you know, your VIPs? So the point is that, you know, these amounts may not be sufficient to cover the shortfall that we have, but they certainly don't compare to the commitment that we have in keeping up these areas of excess and luxury compared to the pain the public is meant to feel. So I think it's quite important to have a report looking into line items in the budget that could be cut, and importantly, it'll show goodwill, not because they're going to replace perhaps any other interventions or measures that need to be taken. But I think we need to seriously come to the table and say, well, if we're expecting the public to feel this pain, this is the amount of pain that can be cut from the end of the government. And I think that's so very important. So there's two things. The first is to say that we actually have to address the causes of the problems and not just the outcome. And second, say what is the pain that the government is prepared to feel, the commensurate to the pain that the public is expected to endure to address the failures of the administration.
Thank you very much. Who's next? Mr. Mania, and then Seko, Mchilengwa, and Dumisani. Thank you. Can we move on to Mr. Mchilengwa? Mchilengwa, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I think the question is quite very direct, in the sense that whilst welcoming the fact that there's an independent panel to look at the list of zero-rated items, obviously we've got 19 items now, and then we take the scenario that the list moves from 19 to 28. The increase on that list is going to, of course, result in a decrease in what you will be collecting in VAT. And as the judge has said, that next year that's not an option. So whatever it is that you're projected to raise with the VAT increase is going to decrease somewhat as the year progresses once that list is amended. I'm not, of course, saying the fact that the judge now raises a different perspective, which says, well, maybe should we be finding other ways of redistributing the 23 billion to the poor as opposed to the zero rated list. So what I'm essentially asking the chair is that the options are increasingly becoming minimal to the future to the generator. And then the question then becomes, Judge, is you have said, you asked the question, where else do we go? So we can't be collecting. What have you advised to be the immediate areas of reduction in terms of expenditure, as far as government is concerned? Because obviously we cannot be the jack of all trades. We cannot be covering everything at once. The list of computing priorities continues to escalate. And if our collection is as, you know, troubled as it is, and as you point out, that SARS in itself has got significant problems, as you say, the options are limited. The panel will only come back with a report later, 30 June, and probably the implementation of that will be somewhat in August. So by that time comes, we'll be very much in the full swing of things of the left side. So secondly then is, if that is not an option, what's the other issue that has been registered? Next year people may be expecting that you are going to reduce VAT back to 14%. There's that argument to say, well, this was just to pinch us for 1 year, and that next year we'll have to be going back to 14%. If that's an option, can you just paint the most difficult of scenarios, and rather the hard choices as opposed to the easy choices? As far as I'm concerned, VAT was a soft target, and maybe we'll sort out the problems now, but it's not sustainable. So can you maybe just delve into greater detail in terms of the difficult and tough choices that lie ahead? I know you've touched on some now, and then for us to look at the counter side of the coin to say, look, generation is no longer yielding what we want, economy is on its knees in the main. So what is then the option in terms of the reduction among costs? Paint those scenarios so that we can be able to be in a position to say, is government listening or not? Are they only listening for collection and not for reduction? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Anna. Just a quick point, Chair. We've been having a lot of discussion in the office about money bills in the process of revenue bills and related documents. I think one of the points that we came up with in the clarity around why the parliament have obligations to come up with alternatives if it rejects government proposal. So I think it's an issue that needs to clarify that, because I think the money bill talks about amendment and accept it. It doesn't say much about the rejection. If parliament rejects the proposal, what does that mean? Another point that also we touched on was the issue of touch on some of the public submissions on whether implementing the increase before this process does undermine this process or what does that mean? That's another point we're currently debating in the office. So we thought we should just put it out there. The point, there's a report that I think that the tax committee used a lot when they looked at the VAT. The James Madeline's reform report. It's quite an interesting document, which looks at how should UK, it's about UK, it's about reforming the tax system in the UK. It's quite interesting. I agree with the chair that when we do this comparison or literature, we must try to contextualize it anyway. Nevertheless, it was used. I think one of the points that I want to highlight there, which is very important, is the issue of comparing apple to an apple. I think it's very important. In our view, if we say, when I look at the page 30 of the suggestion, comparing to the country's tax rate, that rate, it is alarming to say, but this is not really helpful as it is. It, you need to talk about, look at the economy at home and the child society and social community issues that must come in, which give us a very useful picture. But again, in that report, Judge, it's one of the fundamental points that comes to say, if we reform or we look at the types of changes and so on, it needs to come with greater objectives. What are the objectives of reform? What are the key issues? In a way, if you're going to impose the tax on the economy, what is the real objective? Are you trying to deal with inequality, development, or are you trying to deal with, what are the key objectives? So I think to myself, Chair, it is very important to start debate in this issue from that point of view. What is the objective here? I understand we need to plug the gap, but you can't have a contradicting policy product. If you have inequality, you can't distribute inequality, poverty on the other side, and on the other side, you propose a potential to undermine that objective. So I think that's the point that came out for me was very important in that the review by Marvin. Coming back to the issue of comparative.
Final question, please, because we're going to pass out of time.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Quickly, I'll run through. Okay. quickly running through the international code, but I think when you look at different countries, because I think we've been doing a lot of work of stuff for more than a year now on looking at international tax rates and so on, but our analysis there is shows that South Africa generally is faring well in terms of tax rates comparative with its peers in a way. When you look at developing countries, developing countries largely rely on VAT and PAT compared to developed countries. There's been a lot of shifts over the years from developed countries particularly where they rely heavily on consumption or consumption.
Okay. All right. But I'm sorry to cut you off, right? But we really want to hear the public, okay? Judge, you want to leave at 12, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Right. It's the public. It's a public hearing. That's what it is. Judge.
The point made is the point made by Alan whatever they have. In a sense, if I take those together, much of this depends on what kind of state you want. There's a philosophical difference here. I don't think government gives up anything. Because government isn't some entity, some metaphysical entity, which has benefits. Government's supposed to serve the people. And so if government gives up, the question doesn't, it gives up on behalf of the people. Question, which people? And so the real issue, where you're right, is that expenditure becomes vital. And we have to prioritize expenditure. That's not our job as the tax committee. I've got my views on it, but that's not my job. But what I am saying is, and that's the point, is the tax system should be there to capacitate the government to be able to create a transformed society. That's what really it's about. And when we look at things like expenditure, or you're right, of course, you look comparatively, I'm more than prepared to accept that we didn't just simply, you know, in some rigorous and ridiculous way say, because they do this in England, we should do it in South Africa. But the real question is, what options do you have that ensure that the revenue that is collected does actually go to the objectives which are chosen by politicians, not by us, by a democratically elected parliament. That's what democracy is about. What we've got to be able to do is ensure that we advise on a tax policy that is both efficient and legitimate. It's not a question of ex post facto. It's that if you've got 0.93% wealth inequality, the argument becomes even more powerful that the salary earner, like you and I, who may have to pay up to 45% tax rate, why should people with huge amounts of wealth who essentially get away with it by free dividends and huge wealth accretion, pay far less? There's something profoundly wrong about that. And that's part of the problem. So to come then to the broad questions that were being asked, well, you did right. The issue of VAT is a short-term solution. I don't know what's going to happen next year, but I can say this. If we could grow, even I saw the president suggesting we might be able to grow 2-2.5% or more. And I'm just saying, assuming we could, and please God that we can, part of the problem is alleviated, because to a large degree, then you're going to get more revenue in any way. If I'm right in my instinct, which I'm assuming is what the president's instinct was, that when he suggested that there should be an inquiry into SARS. And by the way, that inquiry isn't so much, seems to me, necessary to find out what went wrong. It's rather, how can we get it all right? How do we recapacitate? Now, I was involved as part of the Tax Commission when we totally recapacitated SARS, which became one of the great jewels of the democratic crown. We had a SARS that was unbelievable. I mean, you think it through, after 1994. It was one of the most major achievements of government. Now, it's that kind of inquiry, to go in there and say, what can we get right now? How do we do this in answer to the certain questions today? How do we get a wealth register that works properly so we can have a proper wealth tax? How do we actually find the money that, in fact, people, you know, if I was going to give advice, I would want some serious people in there now to be going through these Panama and all these other papers and everything else. And I would want to make sure that I haul a whole series of high-profile people before the courts. Because one or two criminal prosecutions, and my goodness, you'll see how much money you'll get. Right? It just concentrates the mind. So the answer to your question, which is a critical one,
is that what I'm suggesting is that the menu of tax options are limited, but that doesn't mean the options are limited. So what I mean by that is, let's try to be rigorous about this. I hear, for example, you know, people say, oh, well, there's like, if we simply got a grant of the overseas money, we'd get trillions. But all of it, when you test all of these NGOs and others, when they give you these advice, right, all of those figures are very dubious and don't stack up. So you've got to give advice that actually is concrete. And the concrete advice would be that if we can get SARS right, if we can get the growth rate up, then it seems to me, yes, it would be, we would then be perhaps in a situation where one, we could perhaps drop that down to 14, or you may decide, because that's a political choice, that you'd rather use that money elsewhere. And there's an important question I want to raise, Chair, which free marketeers love to cite. Right? They say, oh, you can't have a GDP tax to GDP ratio above X. 15, you know, if you, the free market foundation, I suspect it's about 3%. But what I'm suggesting is that people give you different rates. I went to speak to the World Bank about that when I started my commission. And I'll hasten to add, they aren't a bunch of Trotskyists when I last were. And what I'm merely saying is, they said to me this, which I find very interesting. They said, well, what state do you want? I said, what do you mean by that? They said, well, if you're a state that's developed, you may have a tax to GDP ratio like this. If you're a state that's trying to reconstruct itself, getting the education system better, getting the medical system better, getting a whole range, getting our technology better, you may well have a much higher tax to GDP ratio. There's nothing wrong with it. It depends upon where the money goes to. If it goes to capital expenditure, that's good. So what I'm saying to you in answer is, we shouldn't be hung up about that. The question, however, is, can we collect efficiently in circumstances where we don't retard our great potential? So if you ask me, looking down my periscope, what would I be suggesting to government in 2019, all other things being considered? Well, the one thing would be that I hope by then that SARS, that we've got answers on the SARS question. Two, I would certainly be having a very rigorous audit of transfer pricing to see how much money we can get in from base erosion and profit shifting. There is money there. Three, as I've indicated, I would, in the interim, have a much tougher estate duty regime and be on my way to developing a wealth tax system and then comparing whether we need the wealth tax or the estate duty can do the job. And fourthly, in circumstances where the growth rates might be going up, I may well consider some increase in the personal income tax at the top end for a simple reason, that it does seem to me that we shouldn't again be hung up about marginal rates at the top end in a country like ours, because the conditions of South Africa are the things you have to ask us of, and there's enough economic evidence from Atkinson, etc., to suggest that may not be such a terrible thing. Now, when it comes to the question of that, we were not asked as the panel to suggest, should you go back to 14%? But what we were asked is, what options are open? Let me give you an illustration of what an option could be open. It could, if we, for example, decided that we wanted to use more of the money that we use in zero ratings to target correctly, why should we not consider ensuring that every single rural school in this country has a proper meal for every child at lunchtime, so that in fact every child gets a proper nutritious meal? That improves educational quality. You cannot study when you're on an empty stomach. So I'm not saying that's the only solution, but what I'm inviting is us to think laterally, to kind of look at our conditions and then ask ourselves, what's the best option available? So the menu isn't a great menu, but there are things within each of them. Each of them makes contributions. The BEPS will make a contribution, the estate duty will make a contribution, the plugging the holes in the tax morality makes a contribution, the ensuring that people actually bring their money back. And there's just one other thing about that, if I can, by way of final comment, Chair. I do think we're in the position where tax morality may improve, because I think we shouldn't discount the new mood in the country. And that new mood we need to exploit. And the answer, the reason why I'm exploiting, is to say we're all in this boat together. And it may be only short term, But you see, it's all very well telling me that we're going to reduce expenditure and do that. But in the short term, when you're running a 48 billion shortfall, or 36, whatever it is, you can do the government expenditure stuff if you can get it right. You can squeeze out the corruption, which you should be doing. The difficulty is you can't be sure how much you can get in the year. So in the short term, you've got to be certain. Why? Because if you get it wrong, your interest costs go up. And instead of 12 cents in the RAM, it becomes 16 cents in the RAM, and that becomes unsustainable. So I agree that if we go back, if we look at 2019, I would hope that we would have an administration that would ensure that every RAM goes where it should do, that far less corruption takes place, that far less unauthorized expenditures reported, all that fight. And if you take that together with some of the suggestions I made on the other side, which are not radical, it seems to me that we get far closer to a solution than we are in prison.
Okay, thank you very much. I know we've got many, many questions. I'll call online. I want to say very quickly, we don't want to preempt the panel's outcome, right? We're going to consult with everybody. But in your studies up to now, have you done alternatives to zero rating benefit at all, apart from your proposal of nutrition schools? Is there anything? If so, what?
We need
issues of, you know, how the social grants work and where you can target them better. We've not done enough work on them, I have to confess. And one of the reasons, and Momo will confirm this, when we were debating who we should have on that panel, there were two fundamental questions that we asked ourselves, all of us. And me, I just want to say this, I want to pay tribute to Treasury, because really to work with these guys is just extraordinary, the amount of work that they do and how well they do it. I mean, we really have a top flight Treasury in this country, and we should be grateful for that. And when I'm working with them, they say, you know, we said, look, can we do two kinds of things? On the one hand, we obviously want people who know about that and the zero ratings, but we also want people from different ideological spectra, because we want to be able to have a proper debate about it. And thirdly, we want people who can bring to the table possible alternative options other than the zero rating. So the answer is, I can't give you an answer to that now, Chair, but I can tell you, it's an essential issue. And if I can say through you, that one of the things we invite from all members is any suggestions outside and from the unions and everybody else, what can we do to ensure that the maximum amount of money that we put into the efforts goes to the people most in need?
So much. Okay, over to Kosato. Look, if need be, we'll call you back as a David Tax Committee. But as your panel, the panel, they will have to report to Parliament, right? Good. Okay.
Just one minute. So I think, Chair, the panel, we've asked them, though the brief of the TGC is only on taxation, we've asked them to look at programs like the school nutrition program. And the one issue I want to differ with the judge is, it's for breakfast. Because you don't want them to have hungry stomachs whilst... And I think on the South issues, what the judge has touched on, fixing it up, I think, is a critical objective that we need.
Help me here, because if we ask them each, we can call the judge back. You've got to leave. Right, okay. Let's have Mania, because he hasn't spoken, and then Tandy. No, we're coming back to that later. Yeah.
I want the judge to say 12.5% has been allocated to the school nutrition program. Now I want you to analyze whether that will be able to address what we want to address, so that when we come back, they can respond to that.
We'll certainly look at that,
yes.
And we'll see whether that's enough.
Because there was an increase of 25%.
And one of the reasons why we've got some experts here on the panel is precisely to advise us on those questions. Absolutely. You can be sure of that, that we will be looking, you know, all options are on the table. And the objective is a simple one, to ensure that any of these increases are alleviated, that the poor, and that's a very large section of our community, that we alleviate all the pressure on them in relation to it.
Right, good. The outstanding questions, okay, the questions to trade now, I understand. We're coming back to it. It's been very, very important to hear the public now. And in the afternoon, we'll come back to Treasury and then call them back next week if we have to. Over to you. You've got your full 15 minutes. Thank you very much, Judge. It's been very, very helpful.
Thank you.
And you can always have tea with Tandy. She loves it.
I'm
very
happy. Chair, I'm going to point to Karen. I think we'll
do it later, so if need be, we'll call them back.
We're going to see them all the time.
Well, what we need is a document.
Yeah, we're asking for the document.
All of it.
Yeah. Right, we said that we are asking for it. So what's the point?
Have Treasury agreed that the...
We have no choice. They have to give it to us. Don't worry. We'll follow up on that. We'll come back to that at the end. Yes, over to you. Thank you. You're only 15 minutes. No, you don't have to use it, but there you are. Thank you. Coalition, are you here? Just to thank you, the reason we wanted you here today is because there aren't enough people to have a second round of hearing, unfortunately. I was surprised. But we're giving you half an hour, and it may be more time, because you're representing 17 organizations. Okay? Good. Thank you. Over to you.
Thanks, Chair. Sure. Yes, thanks, members, for giving us space to raise our issues, and I think in the spirit of Judge Davis, I was just contributing to an ongoing debate. I think, Chair, we must say as COSATU, in fact, Chair, let me apologize, sir, but I just wanted to make mention to the committee. I'm not sure if everybody knows about the pathway of Comrade Ghost Blackie, a very good comment from Treasury about 2 weeks ago. And I think, Chair, we wanted to say as COSATU, thanks to Treasury for really helping to make his farewell a fitting one for the family. So.
Can we wrote to the family and we asked members to go to his funeral, and many of us were not around in Cape Town, his constituency town. Yeah, we have a moment of silence. Actually, it's valuable that you mentioned it. The Ghost was an excellent parliamentary liaison officer, and we wrote to his family. He's got only his wife passed away, so we wrote to his two children. He was also an activist, a very quiet person. Nobody seems to know him, but these are the people who fought so that we've got this multi-party democracy. And people can come and protest here against the president, which is Mehrad. So let's stand up. We ask the people, somebody can translate for them, Sakela or something like that. Can we please stand?
So we did have a moment of silence in the committee for him.
Oh, you did already?
We did.
Oh,
okay.
All right, but this is a public hearing. There's no arm raised again. Yes, please. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair. Look, I think as COSATU, we want to state again our strong rejection of that hike. We view it as a very painful blow to workers who are struggling. Having said that, Chair, we do appreciate government's precarious financial strength and, of course, the need to manage the rating agency's guillotine hanging over our head. But, Chair, our anger as COSATU that workers are facing a huge economic crisis. We feel that this year there's really been a barrage of anti-worker tax hikes, and that government has not gone far enough to come with alternative options besides the VAT hike. But we have got about 3 sets of proposals for COSATU looking the way forward. Chair, we don't deny the government's reasons for the need to raise additional revenue. The issue of fiscal sustainability, managing the rating hike, the rating agencies rather, losing massive amounts of money to corruption and wasteful expenditure, the issue of the collapsing state-owned enterprises and the cost of bailouts. I see today SAA is asking for another 5 billion revenue. And of course, Chair, I think we've been waiting for a long time the declining revenue collections under SARS, what we view as a then a deeply compromised leadership. Chair, I think our question is around the reasons for the hike is who is to blame for it, and then who is to pay the bill or suffer. I want to say, for SARS, Chair, there are not workers who have looted SAA or ESCOM or handed over money to the doctors. It's politicians, it's their families, it's their friends. Not all politicians, we want to excuse the chairperson, but many politicians, Chair. And now we're sending the bills to workers, to nurses, to teachers, to police officers, and say, well, we've looted, some of us are still looting, but please pay the bill, because we know you've got no choice. You can't, as a teacher, fly to Dubai, etc. Chair, also as COSATU, we view that as regression. Despite whatever international party table discussions might have, that the rich pay more. That might be true because the rich have more money, but the income blow to workers is much more painful. If 46% of workers earn below 20 rand an hour currently, taking that extra 1 rand from their wages is a painful blow. And of course, the other tax types of fuel, as the judge has mentioned, RAF, etc. I think Chair will also mention or highlight the ticking nuclear time bomb of ESCOM. I think you've seen ESCOM recently has gone to NERSA saying they have under-projected their revenue needs. They need to claw about 66 billion rand. They need an additional set of hikes of up to 30%. And of course, Chair, workers have been molested across the country by municipalities fundraising through above inflation water tariff hikes. Chair, this is in the climate where public service posts are being cut, SMEs are looking at retrenchments, service delivery is being downscaled, one out of three workers is unemployed. We've seen about 72,000 mining jobs lost in 2 years, and other sectors, thousands of retrenchments. Besides the free fees for certain households, we've not seen much measures by the state to assist workers. We've not really seen a push by the state to increase taxes on the rich. Chair, our reasons for opposing the anti-poor VAT hike is a couple. One, worry, what happens next year? Are we going to have another VAT hike? Because again, government's going to be in a financial bind. Chair, how does this really help 1% jobless growth? We are hoping, and we appreciate the leadership of the President for the Job Summit, which is coming soon. We're hoping that will kind of start getting the nation moving. Chair, we applaud the President for finally removing the Commissioner of SARS, or suspending him. That was long overdue. But I'm not sure that's gone deep enough, Chair. We don't know if all the problems of SARS were because of one individual. We've waited since October last year for the Commission of Inquiry. So, Chair, I've called for action around SARS. Those are the things that we were short for in 6 months' time, etc. But we have seen some green shoots with SARS, which we appreciate. Chair, we appreciate the President and Comrade Pravin Gordhan's interventions at the SOEs. But again, are they enough to really turn the boat by next year? And again, Chair, the leadership of ESCOM, we appreciate Pakamari Kadebe being deployed there. We hope to get a longer than a 3 month deployment. But, Chair, that threatens all the work government will do. That really is the time bomb threatening the entire state. And again, Chair, we're not sure come next year we'll be in the same boat. Chair, we would call upon the President to also release the National Director of Public Prosecutions, because government's effort to clean up the corruption in the state is not going to move forward if we have the same compromised leadership at our law enforcement agencies. Our proposals, Chair, for starter to your good self, remember, is one is to cancel the VAT hike, and then to look at a variety of other tax measures to meet the revenue shortfall. We think if, based upon some recent research we've seen from this, if you increase company income tax by 2%, you could raise 13 billion, you increase capital gains tax, you could raise about 4 billion, increase income tax for those earning above R1 million to 45%, that will help estate inheritance tax. We know change is a much more difficult thing for Treasury to do, cumbersome, complicated, but again, Chair, we'd rather have Treasury struggling to do stuff than just simply pass the bill for looting to workers. Chair, one plea we would have for Treasury, the government, and yourselves is for a systematic campaign to crack down on customs fraud, especially with regards to tobacco and clothing. We've seen in 1 year about R7 billion under-reporting of Chinese clothing imports to the country. I think we all know about the scale of tobacco looting and how they've compromised people themselves. Chair, we think really there's a need to go. Chair, according to the Global Financial Integrity NGO, between 2001 and 2010, we lost about R30 billion a year in revenue, state revenues, because of illicit financial flows. I think President Obama did a lot of research around it, and really need to see a plan from government how to address that leak. Chair, that proposals are basically twofold, in addition to cancelling the hike. One is to expand the zero rating goods, necessity goods, and the second is to look at our second luxury badge for certain luxury goods, possibly of 20%. Chair, I think in terms of the expansion of the VAT exempt products, we could look at poultry, which should help the poultry sector, which has been bleeding because of imports. We look at flour, brown bread, sorry, white bread, sugar, canned beans, margarine. Please don't try to get me about polony, Chair, but hopefully it's still in my labels. Chair, we also want to put a strong plea that we look at water and electricity. We think that might be an easier intervention administratively for the state, because those are things that fight. And now, Chair, we know that we need to have a progressive basis. Some municipalities like City of Cape Town, before the DA, some of us still in the ANC. Obviously, Comrade David has left, but on the future Comrade David, we're trying to recruit him. They have a progressive sliding scale. We think you could expand it a bit. Say, for example, if your target is 7.5 kiloliters of water per household per month, the first 5 kiloliters could be VAT exempt. The next 2.5 could be a VAT. Above 7.5, a luxury VAT rate. So there is a basis. That's much easier for me to enforce than simply chasing shop like pick and pay, etc. And it could make a huge difference to people. Same with the electricity chair. The ESCO might have a heart attack. Chair, we also think the issue of medicines needs to be brought on board. And again, maybe that might be easier to do it through pharmacies, through the Medicines Control Council, etc. We'd want to raise the issue of essential toiletries, especially sanitary pads. We had long been saying that sanitary pads should simply be bought by the state and distributed at schools, tertiary institutions, clinics, etc. That's one option. Otherwise, look at the VAT exempt. Of course, we've already seen elements of corruption around the sanitary pads in the Department of Education in KZN and Northern Cape. But again, we must keep pushing. There's some other things we can look at as well. We think it'll be especially useful to look at educational items, stationery, school uniforms, textbooks especially. I think lastly, Chair, that and we know it might be difficult administratively for Treasury, but I think, Chair, there is scope to have a second luxury badge rate that could be based upon luxury goods, yachts, for example. It could be based upon imports where local products do exist or can be produced. I think, Chair, you could also look at products above a certain price range. So for example, you can look at cars, which the ministers like, at a value of about 500,000 or 750,000. We think, Chair, those additional levies could help compensate for a shortfall in the state, Chair. Chair, I think lastly, we appreciate government and the minister setting up this VAT review panel. We really would have hoped you could have done that last year before dumping this tax hike on it. It would not be a reactive thing, but nonetheless, here we are. We're hoping our contributions will make a useful assistance to it, and we'll be available as Cassandra to participate in it. That's in a nutshell, Chair. Thanks very much.
Yes, I'm really fast coming. That's fine, that's your right. I identify with a lot that you said personally, though. South African Medical Association, are you here? Welcome. We haven't had you before in our committee. You have a slide presentation, sir. Okay, you are good. Countries,
Brazil, Russia, India, China. This is where they are. But it's very important, the reason why I mentioned this is that despite that, multiple country factors need to be considered before you make any conclusions about that social inequity. And South Africa is one of the most inequitable societies in the world. A lot of our people in South Africa live below the poverty line, and therefore the proposed VAT increases will impose a huge burden on the South African society. If you look at tobacco and alcohol excise duty, we just wanted to mention this. Obviously, there will be increases in taxes, as we mentioned. SAMA is a member of the World Medical Association, and just include here statements regarding this increased taxation of tobacco products using the increased revenues for prevention programs, evidence-based cessation programs and services, and other healthcare organizations. The World Health Organization framework, there's recognition that price and tax measures are an effective and important means of reducing tobacco consumption by various segments of the population, in particular young people. But despite the international acclaimed effective tobacco policy in South Africa, unfortunately since 2010, tobacco excise tax increases have become less effective for increasing tobacco consumption because of the excise tax pass-through to consumers became lower than the pre-2010. And secondly, we recognize that the addictive element in tobacco use, hence the price inelasticity of demand despite the price increases. People still continue to smoke in spite of that. And SAMA recognizes that the huge burden related to tobacco use and contends that a 6 to 10% tax increase is not likely to have a maximum effect. Since 2006, excise taxes and VAT combined has remained unchanged at about 50% of the retail price of cigarettes. SAMA recognizes the validity of evidence that calls for tobacco excise levies to account for at least 70% of the overall retail prices of tobacco products, and this will be more deterrent. Same argument could be made for alcohol. Currently, now looking at the basket of VAT exemptions, currently there are all of these that we know about, but these, where we are concerned, represents only a small fraction of what ordinary consumers essentially eat and will need key essential services for normal livelihood. SAMA, therefore, supports the expansion of the current basket of zero-rated food items and the inclusion of key services on the zero-rated list, e.g. meat products, clothing, etc. In conclusion, Chair, revenue generated from an additional tax can be quite substantial. SAMA notes government intention to use this to close the gap, the revenue gap of 36 billion rand. However, SAMA emphasizes that the additional revenue from targeted taxes should be channeled towards health promotion and public health preventive efforts aimed at reducing the high burden of disease caused by harmful substance use and consumption. Thank you very much.
Can you move on to the next input? It's from Saika. No, sorry, why am I saying that? My home boy is a girl, so she who says that necessarily doesn't apply to supposedly marks? Okay. Look, a lot of orders in management, so I don't even know. All right, fine. There you are. Do you want some help? Alan?
No. You gave an excellent input, by the way.
No. No, you can go and have your 2 minutes come, right? If you're right. You're not a smoker, so I don't know what you just had some, okay? But over to you, my friend. You'll introduce yourself, right? You gave a very good input, let me tell you. It's very good input last time. Thanks, sir.
Very empirical and clear and precise and pretty. Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I greet everybody in the House. My name is Julie Smith. I am here on behalf of PACSA, the Peter Maritzburg Agency for Community Social Action. Our presentation talks to VAT, the zero-rated foods and the household affordability crisis. Before I talk to our data about what happened on the 1st of April when the VAT hike came into effect. I would like to remind the committee why in February we said hiking the VAT to 15% was not a good idea. The first point is that government does not seem to understand what foods people eat and how meals are prepared. The food baskets of low-income households include both zero-rated foods and foods subject to VAT. The PAXA food basket, which includes 38 foods, which women living in low-income households have told us they typically try and buy each month should they have the money to do so, includes 18 zero-rated and 20 foods subject to VAT. The foods subject to VAT make up 54% of the total cost of our basket. And it means that households living on low incomes are highly exposed to VAT. Zero-rated foods also do not guarantee affordability, and I'll talk to that later in the presentation. The second point we raised was that government does not seem to understand how households living on low incomes spend their money. On low incomes, households identify and prioritize competing expenses. They differentiate between non-negotiable expenses and those expenses they have some measure of control over. So, for example, non-negotiable expenses are transport, electricity, education, burial, and servicing debt. Food is not prioritized first. The food budget arises out of the money left over only after non-negotiable expenses have been paid. And of course, all of these non-negotiable expenses are also subject to VAT. So what it means is that the food budget is already very low and households underspend on food. Our data is showing that households are underspending on food by 25%. Food runs short before the end of the month, and women absorb these shortfalls in their bodies because they don't have any extra savings in order to absorb these increases. So they have to absorb it in their bodies by cutting back on food. And women are getting sick and taking on more debt. So again, it means that households living on low incomes are highly exposed to VAT. The third point we raised was that food is unlike any other good or service. It is not just like any other commodity. Food is core to our bodies. It's core to our minds and our health and our well-being. Food is core to our dignity, our humanity, our ability to be fully human and to be social beings. All of our developmental outcomes, especially education, health and economic outcomes, all of these rest on the ability to put proper, sufficient, nutritious food on the table. So the hike in VAT and the deepening food affordability crisis puts all of our developmental outcomes and our future as South Africans at risk. The fourth point was that government does not control food prices. It does not regulate food prices on our supermarket shelves. Our food is controlled by massive oligopolies. Now, an oligopoly is a Greek for few sell. And when few sell, they don't have to compete on price. South Africans are net buyers of food, and most of us buy all of our food in the supermarket. Our prices are not regulated by the state. The fifth point we said was that food price inflation is highly volatile and wildly unpredictable. And this is seen by the recent drought, where our basket increased by 16.1% between November 2015, when the drought started impacting on our supermarket shelves, and September 2017. Between September 2017 and today, the PAXA food basket has increased by 9%, or 259 rand, which is a substantial amount of money over 8 months. And this is when most of our agricultural regions are supposed to be in recovery. The last and most important point we raised last time we were here was that the majority of South African households face a massive affordability crisis. This has been driven by structural causes of our massive levels of unemployment and our historical low wage regime. Nearly two-thirds of black South Africans live in poverty. 25% of South Africans live below the food poverty line. Since 2015, our cycles of poverty have now accelerated and are escalating. Nearly a third of boy children under the age of five and a quarter of girl children under the age of five are physically, mentally stunted. 9.2 million South Africans are unemployed, of which 8.3 million are black South Africans. The expanded unemployment rate for black South Africans is sitting at 40.7%. Out of 10 black South Africans of working age, only 4 have a job. Most black South African households typically rely on just one wage earner, and this wage must support 3.8 people. The latest median wage data shows that black South Africans earn 3,000 rand a month. If you divide this by 4, you get 750 rand per capita. The national minimum wage at its maximum of 3,500 when dispersed through a family of 4 is 875 rand per capita. This is below the upper bound poverty line of 1,138 rand, which was set in April of last year. The national minimum wage, when it comes into effect, will be a poverty wage. Our unemployment rates have stagnated at extremely high levels. Jobs are not going to come quick enough, and the majority of households cannot put proper food on the table. So last time in summary, we warned that government should not tax what it does not understand, let alone what it cannot control. It cannot accurately predict what the impact of food price inflation will be for households living on low incomes. In this context, we said increasing VAT on a good government has no control over, and which the past 2 to 3 years, the inflation rate has proved to be highly volatile, if not wildly unpredictable. And given the special and crucial role food plays in our health and for all of our developmental outcomes and our social stability, and more so in the context of rising levels of poverty and substantial underspending on food, is very reckless. The 1st of April has shown that our warnings were well grounded. In April 2018, the foods in our basket came to 3,144 rand. This is the highest level we have ever seen. The 1% increase in VAT from 14% to 15% actually resulted in a 6.5% increase in the total VAT levied on the food subject to VAT in our basket. The total VAT amount due was 222 rand. Food subject to VAT makes up 54% of the total cost of our basket. What this shows is that households living on low incomes are highly exposed to VAT. We also need to recognize that the hike in VAT to 15% is still going to take time to run itself through our food value chain. So it means that the rand value of the VAT is likely to increase further. What we also found, which it's really very interesting, is that inflation on zero-rated foods tracks much higher than inflation on VAT-able foods. Between September 2017 and April 2018, inflation on the zero-rated foods on our basket was 13%. And this was much higher compared to the much lower 4.8% on VAT-able foods. So the inflation on zero-rated foods tracks much higher than inflation on VAT-able foods. Our data shows that zero rating does not guarantee affordability. Zero rating just means that there's no VAT on food. It doesn't mean that food is subsidized. It doesn't mean that the food prices are regulated. It does not mean that zero-rated food is affordable. It is also important to recognize that the VAT hike comes when we have a massive affordability crisis. Households living on low incomes are highly exposed to VAT. VAT eats away the little money households have in their pockets to secure the very basic content of life. It will continue to eat away the small increments in social grants and the low baseline wage increases. The VAT hike should not have happened. Government does not regulate food prices. Food prices are highly unpredictable. Zero-rated foods are not affordable. There should be no bet on food. What we are finding is that when it comes to household affordability, it really comes down to how much money is in our pockets. Affordability under a capitalist economy is relative to the level of income and the cost of goods and services. So either government needs to increase wages, or it needs to reduce the prices of foods, or at least regulate them. We are calling for wages to be increased to a living wage, for government to regulate food prices, for food to be made a public good, and for all that to be removed for food. The fundamental problem we face is much greater than an argument against VAT and trying to make it less harmful. Households living on low incomes are not going to be able to afford the VAT increase. Our problems are greater than VAT, however. The fundamental problem is that food is not affordable. The majority of South Africans are facing a food affordability crisis, and millions of our people cannot put food on the table. PAXA does not support expanding the basket of zero-rated foods. Zero-rating is not going to address the affordability crisis. Zero-rated foods are not affordable. Tinkering around and maybe getting an additional handful of food zero-rated might get us a few slaps on the back, but it's not going to address the core problem of the food affordability crisis. It is a structural problem, and we reject this approach. We have to think differently. Food must be made a public good. All VAT must be removed or food, and all workers must earn a living wage. Thank you.
We'd like to stick to half an hour, but you can go beyond this month. We'd rather engage more because you have been here before. Thank you, Chair, and thanks to the committee. For members of the committee who weren't here in February when we made our input, I just wanted to indicate that this followed on from a very detailed submission which was made there. We say we're a civil society coalition, just to indicate that we represent 17 organizations that have been meeting and working continuously on these issues, and that you can read the names of the organizations, but in essence, Chair, they span human rights organizations, advocacy, education, organizations from rural areas, research organizations, and legal advice centers. So I think it's quite a wide range of organisations that are raising their concerns in relation to this bill and in relation to the budget more broadly. So, just to indicate,
this submission we don't have this slide, but we have the thing.
So you've got the submission, Chair.
I haven't got a submission, but it's very helpful to have a slide. So when you're done, can you really try to
show it? Sure. Yeah. So just firstly to indicate that the coalition
rejects the fiscal framework contained in the bill. In particular, its regressive tax measures and the harsh spending cuts that will result from the proposed revenue levels. So we're concerned as a coalition not just about the question of the composition of the tax mix, but also about the question of the cuts in expenditure. We're concerned about the negative effect that these tax measures will have on poor low-income households, as well as the cuts in spending. And our submission that we made in February, I think, makes quite a compelling case that the choices that have been made, unlike what we've heard from the Treasury today and from the Davis Tax Commission, these choices were not inevitable. There were other choices, and we think that our submission shows compellingly that alternative progressive taxation measures are available to the executive. Sorry. We must say that we welcome many aspects of the committee's report, including the statement that the budget must be seen as a means to secure economic growth and transform the economy, and that transformation requires a fundamental shift in the way that wealth is created and shared. We're extremely concerned about the paradigm which is informing both Treasury and the Davis Tax Commission thinking. We think at some point the committee should engage on the broader questions which you're raising, Chair, earlier, which is what is the appropriate paradigm that should inform our choices on fiscal, on tax and expenditure issues in a developing country as unequal as South Africa is. In our view, the budget should be aimed at also realizing constitutional rights, particularly socio-economic rights to food, healthcare services, land, housing, water, education, social security, and social services. Unfortunately, this year's budget and the revenue-raising proposals contained within the bill fails in these regards. And I think that, in our view, it's purely spin in this year's budget speech to claim that these things have been protected in this year's budget. It simply does not correspond to the facts when you analyze the various budget allocations. The real cuts that have been taking place in spending, and by real cuts we mean spending after inflation plus the growth of the population. So per capita spending, real spending, has declined over the last number of years, and we're heading into a period of full-blown austerity if we don't change tax. So the magnitude of overall revenue raised and the distribution thereof will of necessity entail cuts or limited increases for essential social expenditure. This includes education, health and social welfare, as well as economic infrastructure. And who does this hurt in the end? It hurts disproportionately the vulnerable groups, the poor, low-income households and women and children who rely heavily on state services. PACFA has already outlined how the increase in VAT is beginning to bite and impact disproportionately on those households. We welcome the concern which has been expressed by the committees regarding the reductions in infrastructure grants as part of the expenditure saving, and support the call for National Treasury to undertake spending reviews, and that they should quantify and manage the impact of cutting capital budgets on service deliveries, schools, clinics and hospitals, given the current backlog. The problem, Chair, is we make these statements, we request Treasury to do these things, but do they go beyond mere statements, or are they reflected in the following year's budget? And we suspect strongly that this will not be reflected in the medium-term budget policy statement, although we hope to be proved wrong. We support a review of the public sector wage law, but Chair, avoiding the mantra that the public sector is consuming disproportionate amounts of share of resources, and then avoiding the reality that there's a critical shortage of personnel in frontline delivery posts, in health, education, and other services, That review needs to look at how to both protect those personnel, but also to expand the personnel in critical posts. We believe that the critical issue about the VAT type is that it increases the regressivity of the tax mix. As you were saying earlier, Chair, it's not a technocratic debate about how regressive or progressive the impact of VAT is. The real debate is what the impact of increasing VAT is on the overall tax mix. Does it make it more regressive or does it make it more progressive? And clearly, the increase in VAT and the fuel levy makes the tax mix more aggressive. It increases the taxes paid by poor and low-income households and reduces their spending. We also don't believe, and this relates to the point that I made earlier about inappropriate paradigms, we also don't believe that this notion that our current rate is below the global and African average is at all relevant in the South African situation. And we certainly don't believe that, as Treasury was implying earlier, they would misjoin some race to the bottom, whether it's with Trump or other African countries, but that our priority must be to address our development challenges. So we totally reject the view, Chair, that VAT is the most appropriate way of raising additional revenue. Raising VAT can not only have a negative impact on poor households, but it can stifle economic growth, spur inflation together with the fuel levy, including on basic foodstuffs and other essential goods. But critically, as PACSA showed, lead to a fall in household in disposable income. Just at the time that government is introducing a very modest national minimum wage pegged at a low level, these increases are going to eat away at that improvement in workers' income. Therefore, we believe the bill should be rejected. We welcome the committee's strong stand on the importance of zero rating, as well as the government's decision to establish an expert panel to review the need for additional rating of, zero rating of essential goods. However, it's important to note, and here we agree with PACSA, that zero rating is not a panacea to ensure that poor and low-income households have access to basic foods and other essential goods and services. This requires not only improved incomes, but also rethinking the manner in which society gains access to basic goods and their associated supply chains, as well as other measures to support and provide better services for poor and low-income households. It's important to note that approximately two-thirds of VAT zero-rated items, the poorest 70% derive more than 70% of the financial benefits of zero rating. This runs counter to the current narrative that the bulk of zero rating benefits the wealthy. This indicates that VAT zero rating is both an effective pro-poor measure and can, in certain instances, be better targeted. And there's a slide in our presentation, Chair, which we will distribute, which basically shows that for all the green areas, all those these are existing zero-rated items, in all those green bars, the deciles 1 to 7 who don't pay income tax benefit to a proportionate amount from the VAT zero rate. So in terms of reducing the regressive impact of the VAT increase by increased budget for social programs, we welcome the expanded mandate of the expert panel to consider additional means of reducing the negative impact of the VAT increase for the poor, for example by a social grant or the school nutrition program. However, we're very concerned, Chair, by the terms of reference released by Treasury yesterday, which restricts the expert panel's review and recommendations to, quote, the confines of the current fiscal framework as proposed in the 2018 budget, including for revenue and expenditure. This, in effect, ties the panel's hands and prevents them from creatively looking at recommendations that will provide substantive relief for poor and low-income earners. We therefore call on the Parliamentary Committees on Finance to lead the charge for substantive reforms to mitigate the impact of the VAT increase on poor and low income earners. We also don't accept the narrative, Chair, that it's either zero rating or it's social grants or it's targeted increases to the poor. Programs that result in direct cash transfers or price reductions for poor and low income households should be prioritized, such as increases to social grants and avoiding complex systems of conditionality. It should also be noted that the majority do not receive social grants. All those aged 18 to 60 currently don't qualify for social grants unless they're, for example, disabled, and that a system of comprehensive social security should be on the table. This does not replace the need for further zero rating of plastic goods. These are complementary, not mutually exclusive interventions, or the need to explore changes to the food system. We also just want to raise a concern before I go on to the issue of the wealthy and their contribution, Chair. The David Tax Commission has already issued a report rejecting the extension of zero rating. We feel it's a conflict of interest. We have the highest regard for the Chair of the panel who's been appointed, Professor Willow. But as the primary author of the report on that by the DTC, which rejected the extension of zero rating, we feel it's a conflict of interest. And we think that that is a matter that the committee needs to address. On the role of the wealthy in paying their fair share, I don't need to emphasize to this committee the extent to which wealthy South Africans continue to live an extraordinary opulent lifestyle amid a sea of poverty and deprivation. And that taxation is not just about raising revenue, but it has an important role to play in redistribution and transforming the economy. Fair taxation also contributes towards social cohesion. The fact that the VAT increase was not accompanied by substantial other taxes on the wealthy increases both the reality and the perception of an unfair system which makes the poor shoulder the burden. And the impression is that all sorts of technocratic excuses and reasons are found as to why these taxes on the wealthy cannot be introduced or increased, and all sorts of technocratic reasons are raised as to why that is the most efficient system, etc., etc. Actually, in our submission, we draw attention to the fact that there's extensive arbitrage and avoidance of VAT as well, both internationally in the UK, there's been major controversies recently, as well in South Africa, and the submission draws attention to that. Our submission in February showed in detail how increases in corporate income tax, personal income tax on high income earners, luxury consumption taxes, and wealth taxes on net wealth or fixed property could close the necessary fiscal shortfalls. And we were a bit alarmed by the zigzagging in the DTC presentation between this recognition that there needs to be a much more focus on reducing levels of income inequality through these forms of taxation and the suggestion that this is not viable in the short term. As the judge indicated, these are matters of political choice. And again, we think that the committee has indicated in their report that the Treasury needs to give serious attention to this approach. But if we listen to Treasury this morning, Chair, it's no different in tone and approach from the February input. It's like none of this has been said, the committee hasn't spoken, civil society hasn't spoken, and we don't believe that Treasury has any intention of reviewing its current approach. On the issue of efficient tax collection and expenditure, we completely support what the committee has said and what Judge Davis said this morning about the need for an overhaul in SARS. There needs to be much more to reduce corruption, wasteful and unnecessary expenditure, and the need to clamp down on tax evasion and avoidance and improve the efficiency of tax collection. But we have on the one hand the ultra-rich and the large corporations doing everything in their power to evade taxes in the way that Judge Davis was talking about earlier. And on the other hand, the most competent and capable people having been being purged from SARS in order to do this. So again, we think this is something that the committee needs to put real political clout behind urgent interventions to deal with these matters, both in dealing with tax evasion by the corporations as well as the issue of SARS restructuring. We're concerned, Chair, with the speed and gusto with which National Treasury aims to reduce debt levels, although we do not favour unchecked borrowing. And we indicate in our submission that we've looked at the issue of debt levels by international standards, etc., etc. The issue is not the problem of debt, the issue is how debt is used in order to develop the economy. On state-owned entities, we support the view that SOEs, as the committee has said, can support economic transformation, etc., and strengthen the state's ability to accelerate national development. We view with caution, however, the support given by the committee to private sector participation in SOEs, and believe the statement is preemptive and in need of deeper interrogation. And there is extensive research and evidence on this particular issue, which we could engage further on. On the issue of public engagement, we appreciate the seriousness with which the committee took the issue of changes to the tax system and the need for public engagement in this regard. However, Chair, in our submission, we outline the fact that the consultation and engagement by Treasury was completely inadequate, and has the instruction from the committee has not been fulfilled. They are attempting to correct this at the moment, but we think this is something that the committee needs to monitor very closely. So, just coming to our proposals, Chair. Firstly, we propose that the VAT rate needs to be returned to 14% as from April 2019, at the latest. We would like to see that happen earlier. Secondly, we want to see the expansion of zero rates of basic goods, and I'll come back to that. Thirdly, at least a further 3% increase in social grants beginning in October 2018, accounted for through the adjustment budgets. In particular, the child support grant of 400 Rand a month must be increased. It is currently the lowest grant and below the food poverty line, which, as we've seen, is rising with the VAT increase. And fourthly, the increases in the 2018 NTVDS to social programs following a detailed process of engagement that directly reaches the poorest households. We need to ensure a guaranteed minimum annual social grant increase of CPI plus 3% for the next 3 years. As we know, social grants have been eroded steadily over the last number of years by inflation, and we want to remind the committee again that when we talk about inflation, we talk about inflation that affects the lowest quintiles, which is a higher inflation level than the CPI level measured by Stats SA, and has an important element of food in that basket of inflation for the lowest income earners. The initiation of public processes that investigate necessary changes to the food system with the aim of advancing the right to food and eradicating hunger and malnutrition. In other words, Chair, we're saying that we need to take very seriously what PACSA was putting on the table, that tinkering in this regard is not adequate. Thirdly, consideration being given to incrementally introducing a multi-rated VAT system. Here we're quoting the committee's words, in which VAT on luxury goods is higher than VAT on goods bought by the poor and lower income earners. And we would support both the ANC and the opposition's call that the Treasury make available the studies in relation both to this and the question of zero rating, and in fact that resources are made available for civil society to do its own independent in-depth research in this regard, and we're intending as civil society to initiate that process. Then to require National Treasury to hold pre-budget engagements with civil society, hold detailed public engagements on tax policy well in advance of the budget, make available, as we said, in full the evidence upon which it bases its claim that raising direct taxes, such as personal income tax and corporate tax, is harmful to economic growth, including the assumptions and models upon which these are based. And we would respectfully disagree with the judge, as well as with Treasury on this matter, that the use of models is a neutral choice. We believe that inappropriate models have been chosen in the past by Treasury and continue to be used. And they need to engage on evidence, rigorous evidence, which suggests a contrary view. Fourthly, to provide detailed evidence regarding the distributional effects of its proposals. Not a couple of paragraphs in the medium term, or rather in the budget review. The committee should require National Treasury to provide evidence and reasoning regarding the level and rate of proposed reductions in borrowing with a view to optimising potential economic growth. Release a detailed programme of public engagement with the expert panel. And thirdly, ensure any review of the public sector wage bill aims to secure and expand frontline services while reducing wage differentials within the sector. Otherwise, austerity again is a double whammy for the poor, who are hit both by rising prices, but they're also hit by reduced frontline services in their communities. The committee should require SARS to release plans that outline how tax targets will be met, how administrative systems will be improved, how critical vacancies will be filled, not just filled, but filled with staff who are not compromised, and what measures are going to ensure that the rigorous checks are put in place to ensure that they are not compromised. Tax evasion and tax non-compliance to be handled decisively. And civil society would appreciate an engagement in relation to all of these issues that we're raising. We'd like the committee to reaffirm the principle that tax increases should land upon the wealthy, high-income earners and corporations. For the committee to monitor wasteful, corrupt and inefficient government spending in order to shift expenditure to pressing social needs. And finally, to clarify the process by which the 2017 mandate paper by the Department of DPME was authored. If the mandate paper approach is to be maintained, transparency should be established with regards to the process by which it is developed. If the mandate paper is influencing budget decisions, opportunities for participation in the process need to be established. I think the chair and the committee will understand the background to these concerns that are being raised. And we've attached an appendix, chair, on 23 items, which we think should be considered by the expert panel and by the committee in the discussion on zero rating. If you look at the first column, so these are additional items in addition to the existing zero-rated items. The first column identifies food items which are consumed by the poor. The second column has both food items, but it's also got you know, living items such as school uniforms, soap. It's got basic medicines, energy-saving appliances. You know, because it's added some certain issues in relation to electricity and water. So this is not intended to be a comprehensive and exhaustive list, but a list to consider. You'll note, Chair, that there's some issues that may be argued are not exclusively or not going to exclusively benefit the poor, such as, for example, sanitary pads. We argue that these need to be incorporated on the basis of equity considerations, on the basis of the impact on children and gender related issues. Chair, just to conclude, that I'm part of a delegation from the Civil Society Coalition, and there are colleagues with me who would also respond to questions. I understand that you're running short of time, so I'm not going to get into names, etc. Thank you.
I'm going to just reply to this. May I just go quickly?
My name is Olivia Madonka, and I help providing in research and support to IMCJ. Good morning, everybody. My name is Paula Prybuck. I'm a senior researcher at the Children's Institute, University of Cape Town.
Okay, you have 25 minutes. Thank you very much for that, because you could have easily chosen to speak more and you would have been justified. Can I just remind civil society participants that between the two chairs in particular and other members, and certainly the researcher and the content advisor, we will read every sentence, every comma, every full stop, more than ever.
because of the gravity of what's happening here and the complexity of what we have to deal with. The second thing to say is to remind those of you who weren't here the last time. The way our committees function is that whenever we have a hearing, then we invite the National Treasury to reply. And they have to itemize every concrete proposal in the way and policy proposal in the way. And then they will say, civil society says this, some of it, this is our reply. Then you have the chance to reply to them in a wooden certain level, right? And then they reply to you. Having done that, we then engage on the clause by clause. This time around it's more complicated because we have an independent panel process and we have a national treasury process. And we're still not clear how the one relates to the other. Colleagues from national treasury are almost coming back. Or is he caught up? He's going to come back. All right, but what we also ask you to do, remember today, and Alan, I think the world forgot to say this, at the end we ask you to just respond in 5 or 10 minutes to the key issues. Because not everybody who's here now will necessarily come. For what we do the next time around, tentatively, unless there's some disagreement, we've set the 29th of May, because then we'll focus for the whole of the next week after that. Is this right, 29th of May, Alan? Is this been sanctioned by Mr. De Beers, Robert De Beers, secretary? According to the second term program. But we will let you know a week beforehand, right? We might change that because Parliament keeps changing its program beyond our control, like the very day we're in now. You know, they suddenly started to change. So at this stage, tentatively, it's Tuesday the 29th. Is that right? But we'll finalize that. We will let you know at least a week beforehand. So for those of you who can't come, I don't think they can negotiate these things. You don't have any control, right? But channel 408 plays us. Or we can send you a recorder. I don't know how we do this. So that you're not precluded from participating simply because you're not here. So what I'm saying in short is you will get a response. Very detailed. They're very good, by the way, at responding. Can I also lift something up? The quality of the inputs are very good, actually. Very good. Who's the most senior person? Yanga, you are, right? That's correct? Yanga, you have to take these things much more seriously than you've done until now. This is very good stuff. And really, the quality, if you look at the 4 submissions we've received as a whole, I don't know what other colleagues and comrades say. This is really good, you know, from the perspective of a politician. Now, we may have experts on our side, like Rapele and Masani and so on, and Sratle, who might see things, technical and other, you know, but that's what they're meant to do. From what I can see, this is a very good set of inputs. Okay, having said that, let's throw it over to them. Do you want to say something, by the way? Yeah, you can say whatever as you know. But I'm finished now because you take over when we come back. Right, so Gandhi, you have your hand up. Who else? Okay. Just hang on. Who else? Mukuleko and who else? That's it. Oh, then you've got a lot of time. It's only between you and 1:30, 25 minutes. But we've got to give them enough time to reply.
No, sure. I don't have enough questions. For this session, I'm going to ask Nick a few questions that are. Firstly, let me say I welcome this list because then it happens to us to look at which issues need to be added in the list of the related items. But he also put Bologna there. So I'm not sure whether we still want to eat Bologna or not. But the question relates to the suggestion that we need to increase social grants. Social grants have been increased in the current context, but then it doesn't address the category you listed as those who are not receiving social grants. Therefore, I need to request that you make a suggestion in terms of how can we reach out to that category that is not on the social grant program to benefit not only through the zero rating but to have direct benefits. For instance, there was a time where I suggested that we need to have a voucher program.
to help those who are not in established speaking countries. So maybe you might have a suggestion on how to do it. But you are also suggesting that they do this through the medium-term budget policy statement, which will happen later in the year. So maybe you have a suggestion as to how are we going to go with this. In relation to the sanitary pads, you say that it needs to be incorporated to an equity process. Now, if you look at those who will be in need of sanitary pads, for instance, it will be students, it will be unemployed women. So is there a suggestion that you have passed as to how do you make a distributional effect towards that category so that not everybody who can go to a retailer find themselves benefiting, including those who already will afford to buy sanitary pads. So is there a way that you want to make a suggestion as to how we should deal with it? Chair, basically these are the questions that I had.
Okay. Mr. Sharma?
Thanks, Chair. I think it's just two questions. And I think I welcome that Nyamaya Palace is sort of the zero-rated item proposed. But, Chair, firstly, I just would like to go to Heckler. On the very emphatic call for the removal of VAT on all food, as to whether that achieves the objective of what we actually want to do. I'm just getting a sense that there's food that I would classify as luxury food. And now when you're going to just blanket remove all that, I'm just trying to find a midway and a pragmatic approach. If that can just be an impact for the rationale. I know that they've gone into detail, I've read the submission, but I just want to be clarified on the nuances of that call and the practicality of it, and whether that assists. So that's the first thing. Secondly, Chair, there's that consortium presentation, the introduction of a second higher VAT rate on luxury consumption items, possibly of 20%. And I just want to juxtapose that particular proposal to what the judge was saying earlier on when he said one of the efficiencies of VAT collection in South Africa is that there's one rate and that makes administration easier. And so judge was here when that was made, what would be the reaction to that particular situation, because at the same time we do not want to compound tax administration and collections with layers and layers of all sorts of things. So if I can just get a response to that insofar as what the judge articulated earlier on. Thank you, Chair.
Quinn? I think Mr. Meni had to leave because he's preparing for today's afternoon. He'll be back at 2:30. He can't leave you missing it. Okay.
No, I think Elf will be replaced.
Oh, right. Good. Okay.
My contribution was just to say that, you know, I think sometimes what I think is unfortunate sometimes in the interaction between, or at least this is how I'm seeing it today, maybe it's not a generic statement, is that there's far too little analysis of what should be done right, as opposed to, in other words, how, you know, growth measures or, you know, which policies are really are failing and are failing people. And I find that the discussion is often far too much about redistribution. Now, it's not an either-or option, so don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to advance a free market idea saying that there should be no taxation and no redistribution. I'm simply saying that we need to balance comments around redistribution, so how much people must be taxed, how much companies must be taxed, how much the living wage should be, with all the suggestions about we actually need to grow the size of time, we actually need to grow the economy, and what are the policies that the society feels are failing people in terms of achieving that goal, because there's no way that we are going to redistribute or tax ourselves I just think we often throw around these rhetorical words like we need a social compact, etc. But, and I think we need to start talking about what exactly that looks like, how it fails. Because I find that the environment for engagement between business and society is really hostile and quite toxic. There's this assumption that, and not an explicit assumption, but in the tone, I suppose, and how things are communicated, of a vilification thing. And I think, it's important how we can restore that relationship. I think it's an important one. I think it's important that there are people who are struggling with themselves who want to be entrepreneurs. We can't sort of vilify the private sector. There are many poor people who might want to own a business, run a business. And so I think there's quite a constructive conversation to be had there, how we can view everyone as an important stakeholder in this process. I think part of the important part of that is restoring perhaps a bit of that trust. But that's a little bit of political, sentimentality about the nature of that relationship, and it comes out in the way that proposed was suggested, that there's very little proposed about how to improve the business environment, how to spur growth, how to make sure that there's people are skilled for the kind of labour market that we have, the demands for labour market. All the proposals seem to be geared just towards how can we extract and redistribute, or at least the bulk of them. So I think there's a balance in needed in that relationship. And I think also, perhaps just to say, part of the research as well around the tax side of things, and I'm talking about individuals, not the private sector, is that we sometimes underestimate the level to which the so-called wealthy in South Africa are wealthy. Now, of course, you will get some exceptional, really right at the top, to people who are, have exceptional wealth, of course, though those people exist. But actually, when people like throwing around terms, I'm not saying that they're going around here, the general comment, for example, the 1%, and people without realizing how many of us, how many people are actually part of that 1%. So people might say the 1%, thinking this means people who earn about 10 million rand a year or people who earn. But actually, the 1% is probably your average accountant or your average person who's doing well in the educational field. Even globally, 1% is, I can't remember the exact number or pack, but it's not a staggering amount. It's around 500,000 rand a year, which of course is a lot for many people. I'm just saying that's also the amount that perhaps accountants are earning. So, just straight out of almost graduates, I would call it. And so I think there's also a need to balance that realistically about who's actually in the 1% or who's actually who are we talking about when we're talking about the really wealthy, and maybe to try and define that a bit more, because I think sometimes we include a lot of people than we often think. And the secondary part is that when you look at taxation, taxes become a little bit more important if you think about how they are actually used. So it's one thing to say that the wealthy are at, let's say, the top rate of 45%, and that we could go much higher. But also, what's the corollary of that that needs to be looked at is that in many countries where taxes are much higher, the service delivery is also much higher. So the uptake, for example, of private medical aid in the UK is much lower, precisely because if you're wealthy and you pay, or if you pay taxes, you can expect to receive a good public health care. So you're not going to almost double tax yourself by then getting out of private medical insurance. And similarly for education, if taxpayers' money was if that was going well, then you wouldn't both pay taxes and send trying to improve the private schools because they perform better than the public schools. So I think it's quite important to measure the effect of almost effectively double taxation of that. So when you pay taxes, but you actually still don't as a taxpayer rely on the government to provide those services because they're so poor. So I just think that there's good reason to look at all those things. And I think it's also in terms of whether it's tax compliance or, when we motivate for increasing taxes, I just think it's also so much better to sell, to sell tax increases when people actually get, the benefit of high taxes. I think, don't have to then pay for those things that government, you know, that the government provides. But it will never be possible in an environment like Africa to increase personal income tax, other taxes, if there's no return on them, if you don't actually benefit, then you still will have to spend out of your disposable income to finance the very thing just happening.
I just want to ask, are you coming back after lunch, Mr. Curry?
Yeah.
Okay, because I thought you said you weren't, and I'm
No, he would chair, because we co-chair. So the morning session is mine.
Okay, you'll be here, because something has happened after I last saw you, and I didn't want you to run away.
Oh, no, I can't run away.
Okay, thank you.
I can't, it's a public hearing. I can't run away, no. Can I just raise one or two quick questions? Firstly, I really think Treasury, we'd like a detailed response, in particular to the facts and figures, right? Because some of us were very compelled by it. But the issues that facts and figures go beyond the EAT. And so, in fact, the coalition, and in fact, all of you in different ways, but some of the issues they raise are broader issues about transformation of society, particularly in the area of what one might call crude welfare. Pertinent to broader issues. Now, what I wanted to ask was, the one interesting thing that the coalition brings up, Professor Willard, right? They've already taken a position. We'd like an answer to that today. So can you communicate this younger to Momo, or you answer, it's your call, you speak on behalf of Treasury, but it's not a question we need 1 month, 2 months. In fact, why not now? Secondly, this issue of increasing social grants by 3% is high. I'm taken, the second related issue to this panel is, does the coalition want to propose how they think the panel, independent panel, terms of reference to the expansion. We're looking for a realistic expansion. There are limits to what the commission can do. And certainly we'll say what it says, which is a reasonable economic type, which is that whatever you do, remember that these are the goals, raising revenue and expenditure. I don't think, maybe I haven't got it. See, obviously I've got to read these things carefully, and I'll do so over the next week and a half. But there's not enough in these submissions on where exactly you would raise the alternative revenue. Maybe I don't see it there. If I read the thing, you know, fully, line by line, you might pick that up, right? But that's my thing. Then on the issue of zero rating versus like other forms of pro-poor programs. This is something the committee needs to apply to money to. Because at this stage, we need a sort of more intensive discussion. And we're asking for civil society and others who are opposed to the VAT increase, when they come back here, after they've heard Treasury and they've responded, to actually put down in like one or two pages concrete proposals on zero rating and take account of the comments made by the Davis Tax Commission, Judge Dennis Davis and National Treasurer, how hard it is to disaggregate. And some of the work we've already done on the fiscal framework, the reading I've done, and I'm sure others, like Tanvi and so on, we haven't been able to come up with compelling answers because we've got the technical capacity to do so. And you seem to have you had a colleague here, Neil, very impressive in portrait. By the way, somebody saw it on TV and very interested to know who you are, but I'll tell you that it's outside this meeting. For what it's worth, Neil, I don't know his age or the new role you're playing, but it's a very temperate presentation compared to what I know you. Yeah. You know, or maybe it's the tempering influence of Matthew there, whom I teasingly ask if you really fight thin enough to be a PLO of Kolkata. Finally, I am interested that you have curry powder. I wanted to
they
work
together.
Now, I say this because obviously that's what the poor Nabi views. It's consistent with my information. But interestingly, in KZN, the majority will buy spices now. I have an extended family which does deal with spices. African people, right? And I can tell you a few anecdotes about that. But I cook, by the way, as a matter of interest. And curry powder is like a generic thing. There's no such thing, strictly speaking, in cooking. It's a combination, I think, of coriander, cumin, turmeric, and chili, and what's called caramelized, right? But it's a quick thing to do. So I'm just not surprised, by the way, but it once again shows the dominance of the kingdom, okay? In national politics. And it bears no relation to the fact that taxes pay to them to develop. But I am interested that it's there. It surprises me, but, you know, that doesn't surprise me. But, you know, the work we've been doing as politicians so far, we're a bit cautious about the zero rating thing. And we also understand the technical problems. So I am interested also, the coalition is saying, almost saying, or treading on saying, which is slightly different from what I anticipated, that okay, it must stop on the 1st of April 2019. But in the meanwhile, these are the 9 or 10 things we should do as Parliament and the executive. But we want to remind them what Tandy said, that we said it has to be reviewed. It'll be reasonably, we chose our words very carefully, because we want to preempt the outcomes of these hearings. What is the point for the committee to take a decision and then they come to hearings? But on the other hand, we're not playing you. In other words, let's be very frank. We're not saying these things carefully because we're carrying you along and saying, okay, this public hearing and we've heard you and so on. As long as you're threatening to go to the Constitutional Court and so on, it's your right. But, you know, we've been looking at examples and we're asking our advisors to, you're going to find it very hard, I think, to find examples where it's not done like this, but on the other hand, our constitution is much more explicit about our legislation's process. And we've raised this with the executive and the House too. I raised it again yesterday with the Speaker's representative, Mr. Frolic. He said, look, this thing is coming out, and people have a right to report, and we have to prepare for it. That we will have to go in the executive and Parliament. And Parliament, the Money Bills Act. We also want to remind those of you who came late that we have finalized the Money Bills Act phase one. But now there's a phase two that's going to begin. And we really want to look at these broader issues that the VAT process has brought Tucky to the fore. And we'll engage with you in that regard. So having said that, can I hand over then to you to respond? Maybe we start in the order you spoke.
Right, thanks, Chair. I think just five quick responses. I think to Honourable Tandy, please don't interrogate me on Bologna too much. But I think given the crisis there, and even given the crisis in the poultry sector, where we have workers who might lose their job in the factory, etc., this might be the opportune time. And of course, some of our members, for their own reasons, love Bologna. I think even the chairperson from Peter Management loves it as well. He's not denying it. I think, Comrade Chair, on the issue of sanitary pads, look, previously we suggested that the best option there is really for government to buy sanitary pads and distribute it at state schools, state-run tertiary institutions, and even at government hospitals, government clinics, similar to how we distribute condoms, well, not at schools, but I think you can catch a drift. So, there, but though, Chair, I think there the chief procurement officer needs to manage it very tightly, because already we've seen in KZN and Northern Cape where some of our officials are using this as a chance to eat on the side. Chair, I think to Honourable Fengwa, look, we accept tax is complicated, but also so is burdening the poor complicated. It's complicated for workers to make month ends meet. We think SARL has got enough capacity to manage it. They already manage a zero rating for some goods. We're not talking about luxury goods rates for all goods, but a specific category. It can be to luxury goods, to specific imports, but also you can base it upon price levels. So if you buy a car more than 700,000 rand, then it'll kick in, for example. It might take a bit of time, we sympathize with that, But we think it's important to hear that side, because you're sending a message to the poor that it's not just them being squeezed, it's the rich as well. Right now the message this year is that it's just been the poor who are being squeezed. And we'll remind Honourable Members Chair that we have elections next year, and workers are assessing a variety of criteria when they come to the ballot box. But Chair, I think also last minute point is that it's important for government to solve the South issues. Otherwise we are going to be in the same mess in October and in February next year. Chair, so I didn't catch Honourable Gwen's surname, but no, we agree with you that the real solution long term is about how to grow the economy, how to create jobs, how to unlock investment. We are working closely with government on the Presidential Jobs Summit. We're hopeful that that won't be a slogan festival, but a real action plan. Look at ways to look at investments, sectoral targets and plans. What are the interventions needed in different sectors of the economy, from forestry to agriculture to tourism to clothing, etc. So we're hopeful that the minimum wage will come into effect shortly. Also help boost the local economic demand. Chair, I think also proposals around sort of corruption, sort of wasteful expenditure, because then it will unlock more money. I think the fact that the Hawks have identified about 50 billion rand worth of stolen assets, the AG talks about, I think, the 64 billion rand of wasteful expenditure. If you can address these issues, we wouldn't have to get the VAT hike. Chair, we accept the Honourable Gwen's focus on the 1%, and I think as Kosato, our focus is on the 90%. And we accept our different political paths. I think last year, off from a chair, alternative revenue, we've got basically three proposals. One is the basket of company income tax, personal income tax for the rich, inheritance and state duties. We think there is scope to play around with. The issue of a luxury VAT rate. Then I think last year, chair, not to be a broken record player, but the issue of SARS capacity issues. The issue of customs fraud, especially on tobacco, clothing, etc. We think there's massive scope to raise revenue correctly, not having to squeeze your nurses, your teachers, etc. Thanks very much.
So,
do
you want to say anything? Are you fine? Okay, just to alert you before you get horrified, right? We have been approached by the Tobacco Institute and some organizations about the huge amount of money that's flowing out of this country. Not the amount of money that the tax revenue department or SARS is not getting because of illicit tobacco, right? Now, it's not that we support smoking. We all have our own views, right? And you know the views of the Minister of Health, passionate, committed, progressive views, right? But since smoking is not illegal, you may argue it should be made illegal, and some of us in our individual capacities may agree. I would imagine the Minister of Health does, but I can't speak for you. But because tobacco is not illegal, then people must pay the tax on it. Secondly, you know more than us, this illicit cigarettes that come in, some of them are even worse. We don't know, you know more about than the cigarettes that you buy. So we're not supporting necessarily, but we are having on our agenda. And we are going to do it. If people are smoking and people are manufacturing cigarettes for now, whatever our individuals are, they must pay the tax. So we're going to put that on the agenda. It's not a hearing. But what we can consider, colleagues, think about this, we're going to invite SARS and all the organizations. But if we're having a hearing, we have to advertise it. We have to look into this front, whether we can have a briefing that's limited to certain parties. Maybe somehow can come. I'm not sure how it fits in, but certainly the Tobacco Institute can come and so on. But let's think about how we do that. It's not something for immediate attention. I'm just drawing it to your attention because you mentioned, and actually some of us would agree with that. Can I just say, though, that in general, okay, but before I do, let's move on to PACA.
Yeah, in terms of your question, around
the
tax the removal of that for food. When we look at it, for example, for our basket, we've got a basket of 38 foods. This basket has been farmed probably from about 150 foods that women tell us they buy. Because everybody's got their own preferences in terms of what food we like, how we like to cook it, etc., etc. So the 38 foods that we've got are the typical foods that women can agree with would be in their trolleys every month, should they have the money, right? So when we say removal of VAT of all foods, it's kind of linked a little bit to that, and that we can't actually sit here as experts. Like, I don't really agree with the list, okay, so we should zero-rate these foods, because I don't think, on the basis of what women are telling us, I do not think that women would agree on zero-rating just a couple of foods. Because the basket includes more than 50% of that food that you get. So to try to actually work out exactly which are the foods we should be zero-rating is very complex. Hence, it's easier actually just to say, on the basis of principle, should food be a public good or not? We agree that it should be. On that basis, then there should be no VAT on food. There's another angle that we have, is that what is in the best interest of South Africa right now, given this massive food crisis? Right, it's an analysis that we have. It's an analysis, certainly, that StatsSA is throwing out at us every month. I don't think that we can deny the fact that households are really struggling to put food on the table in terms of the income statistics, in terms of the wage level. But in that context, particularly where we have a quarter of girl children under the age of 5 and a third of our boy children under the age of 5 who are stunted, that constitutes a massive political crisis. So how do we respond to that? And again, for us it would be looking at, can we consider that food should be a public good, and that it's in the best interest of South Africa to ensure that every single household is able to put good quality, proper, nutritious food on the table. And if food is the basis and the core of our body and our health and our humanity and our developmental outcome, then surely that's the best possible use of money. That's the thinking that we have around the removal of the VAT of food.
I understand the context at which you say food should be considered a public good, but there are different categories of people in society and they will regard different types of food as food. For instance, the rich will regard caviar and salmon and basmati rice as food. Okay. Whereas in a poor household, what is basic foodstuffs is mealy-meal, it's tea and milk. Now once we come with the concept of all foodstuffs as being public goods, basically we are saying abalone must be regarded as food, which is a consumptionable item, but it's not necessarily basic to those who are. Absolutely. There's so many things that I can make examples of. So I think it becomes important to categorize those basic foodstuffs that are consumed by the poor on a daily basis as opposed to luxury items. And as I'm saying, in principle, we understand why you want food to be classified as a public good, nutritional value and so on. But there are foodstuffs that have nothing to do with nutrition, with growth of children and so on, and are regarded by those who consume them as food. So I think we need to make a distinction so that this helps us to protect the poor, but also be able to collect revenue to those who necessarily consume items that are not necessarily basic foodstuffs to sustain livelihoods. And it's on those basis that I don't even think we will all agree in terms of the list, for instance. I'll argue from a point of view that okay, let me read it.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, my response quickly would be that again, what we said last time we were here around February, in terms of the possibility of introducing a luxury band of foods. And our position would be that if you have to get revenue from VAT, then don't get VAT from households that you know cannot afford the VAT increase. So for example, don't get the VAT or foods that working class households buy. Get it from those households that don't buy those foods. In which case it's much easier, because then it also switches it around, whereas working class households don't have to keep on struggling and fighting for the small zero rated basket. Let the wealthy and the high heels argue about what they want in that luxury basket.
I think we can continue that debate, right? We'll be back in any case. All somebody from PAC are all will communicate. Who's next? It's civil society.
So Chair, I'll start off responding to the questions that you concluded with. One issue that you asked was, you know, don't you need more detail about where alternative sources of revenue would come from? We put up the slides from our last presentation in February. So this one, for example, around increased personal income tax shows in the second column in scenario one that if you increase the marginal income tax rate at the top to 40% from 37%, you would accrue additional revenue of about 27 billion, etc., etc. So that shows that in relation to corporate income tax, different scenarios raising it from 28% to 32% to 35%. It shows what the amounts are that you could raise. So these have been all costed. We acknowledge in the submission that there's some difference between the sort of proportionate amount and the amount that would effectively be raised in certain areas. But what you can see is that the amounts are massive, you know, in relation to corporate income tax, personal income tax, property tax, capital gains tax, wealth tax, the question of cutting the tax breaks on pension, medical, etc., etc. So there are a whole menu of options there, Chair, which are available. And it comes back to the point that we've made, is that we get no sense that there's any serious engagement with these alternatives. The sense is that these alternatives have been excluded, there's no preparedness to engage on them, and we think that that is what the committee, in your report, you've stated very clearly that these alternatives need to be considered. And I think that we now need to be moved beyond that statement to say, how are we going to seriously entertain the evidence, do the research, engage in a meaningful way with the intention of looking at these alternatives. That's the first point. On your question about the terms of reference of the Commission being expanded, you know, we welcome that suggestion, and we would obviously need to discuss as a civil society coalition, and we would revert as soon as possible in regard to that suggestion. In terms of concrete proposals on zero rating, I think you were saying you want proposals on what the additional items would be, etc. But what the clarity that's needed is what the process is that's being followed in relation to these issues around the Commission, in relation to the concerns that have been raised, what the role of Parliament is, what the Commission's role is. But certainly, as you can see, we've been applying our mind to that. I've indicated that civil society is in the process of looking at commissioning research on the impact of zero rating on the many of the items that we've been speaking about. We think the Fiscus, Treasury, should be supporting that sort of research. That's obviously a choice that you would make. I think in relation to the final question, the reason you said you were a bit surprised that we were talking about reverting to the 14%, but we were also talking about extending zero rating. We don't see
I thought you would say stop the VAT now.
Yes.
And we're not going to negotiate. And the Treasury thing, how do we retrospectively go back to the 1st of April? And
and then return people's money. It's not like personal income tax. So I think it's a much more realistic, let's say, I'm welcoming, because we're stuck in that quandary, right? It's going to be hard to, like, retrospectively, like, pay back people. How do you do it practically? So, in other words, we've come, in other words, the paradigm or framework with which we engage in is now easier for us.
So
we're welcoming.
So yeah. Chair, lest I be accused again by you of being overly moderate, which I object to. I'm going to try and correct that in future. I think this represents a recognition by the civil society coalition that we're stuck with a certain reality which we find completely unpalatable,
yeah,
and which we reject. And I think what Pax has made very clear is that this is not an ideological rejection, this is,
yeah,
a rejection in terms of the practical impact. But that it must be a quid pro quo.
Yeah.
You know, if you're moving forward on that basis,
yeah,
then there must be a concrete changes which compensate people who've been hardest hit by this. And thus the issues around literacy. But we see that even if the VAT is end of next year, the zero rating extension should continue. And the same applies to the question of a multiple VAT rate. The question of extending zero rating and multiple VAT rate is a long standing demand of civil society since the 90s. And you know, we can engage further on the issues of practicality, etc. Again, we feel it's more about a technocratic excuse and lack of political will to do certain things. We think, the universities being on fire somehow enabled government to extend basic free education to the university. So I'm not saying that similar tactics are going to be employed, but I think the question about what is possible and what is feasible is ultimately always a political choice. On the question of Tandi raised, Tandi on the question of social... Okay. On the question of social grants, Paula will respond on the question of the extent to which social grants have been increased and whether that's the case. On the question of food vouchers, which you were implying, I think generally would be not happy with the idea of food vouchers because, number one, it stigmatizes the poor. Number two, it introduces a big administrative burden and is subject to corruption. International experience around food vouchers is not a good one. But in relation to those currently not benefiting, those from 18 to 60, who are not on social grant, we know what the demands historically have been for a basic income grant, for the extension of social security to the unemployed. In the NEDLAC negotiations on the national minimum wage, we engaged in some detail on this, and Labour put forward fairly detailed proposals, including on the possibility of a portion of the unemployment insurance fund being ring-fenced for the creation of a work seekers grant. The surplus in the unemployment insurance fund currently is about 135 to 140 billion rand, which is a complete scandal in a country where we have the levels of unemployment and poverty. The Department of Social Development in the early 2000s put forward a proposal for a work seekers grant. Treasury blocked it and rejected it. We've sat in NEDLAC from 2002 to 2017 with no progress on the issue of comprehensive social security. So this is an example of an area where it's no longer the moment for abstract discussions about extending the social security system. There needs to be concrete movement and interventions in this direction. The idea of a comprehensive work guarantee scheme like we've had in India, rather than NREGA, extending the public works program is another route to go, to give every family the right to work up to 200 days or 100 days of work a year. That can also be financed in various ways. So we've put all these proposals on the table. Who's the biggest stumbling block on all these issues? Sorry to sound like a broken record, it's treasury. I'm just going to answer a couple more on the issue of on the other issues, and then Paula's going to respond on the social graphs. We don't want to get into an ideological engagement around what constitutes a growth versus redistribution start at this point. I don't think you've got time for this. But I think the discussion that we raised earlier would be very important in the run-up to the Jobs Summit, either by yourselves or together with other economic clusters, the rest of the economic cluster in Parliament, is an engagement on precisely these paradigmatic issues of growth and redistribution, of development and reduction of inequality. These are not these are not exclusive choices that need to be made. It's about a growth path, which is inclusive, which reduces inequality, which industrializes, which generates jobs, etc. And our argument, it is in fact relevant to this discussion, because the question of tax, increasing the tax base, giving the state more ability to invest in infrastructure, to generate employment, and all these sorts of areas are policy choices which do have a direct impact on the growth part. But as I say, you know, that's something that requires much more in-depth discussion, which we are very happy to have. But I think Paula, just on the social graph issue, I think you're going to comment briefly on the central issue.
Hi, just to reintroduce myself, I'm Paula Prabha. Children's Institute, University of Cape Town, and you know where we are coming at this issue is around children's nutrition and the very high levels of stunting of children at the moment. So I'm going to talk to the question around the increase to social grants using the example of the child support grant. So the increase to the child support grant was 20 rand in April. It was 380 rand before that, so now it's 400 rand. There's another increase coming in October of another 10 rand, so it will be a 30 rand increase in total. But because it's staggered, it just makes the CPI inflation mark for the year. So it's a staggered increase. So for 6 months, it's only a 20 rand increase, and the next 6 months, it's a 10 rand increase. And as Pat has pointed out, and Neil also pointed out, that CPI is not the level of inflation that affects poor households. One should rather be looking at the food inflation levels. So the grant increases do not keep pace with food inflation levels. They're behind that. So the budgets of poor households are decreasing, and the capacity to buy food is decreasing. So we have asked in our submission that Treasury must actually produce evidence to back up the statement that the increases to the social grants will compensate for the VAT increase. As we've seen from evidence in April, the increase for poor households' expenditure on food is very high. And I think if we reflect on April, how it must have been to be a social grant beneficiary who's dependent on these very low grants, there was the VAT increase, there was the fuel increase, there were the bus strikes, which for many people meant double transport costs because they'd already bought the bus ticket. So taxi fares would have to be paid on top of that. And I don't know if you're also aware that for 8 million grant beneficiaries, as of 1st of April, they have to pay approximately 20 rand bank charges per month because of the change over from Springboard Bank to Sarko and the private banks. So April was a very bad month for grant beneficiaries. When Neil said, you know, we're calling for the VAT increase to revert in April 2019, and you know, we understand that Parliament is going to struggle to do anything about it before then, we are asking for a quid pro quo in the form of the zero rate items being increased, as well as the increases to social grants. And the increases to social grants happen every year, either April or April and October. So it is very easy. It is very easy to make an adjustment in the October budget to actually compensate and provide a quid pro quo for the impact that the VAT increase this year is having on poor households. Then there was also a question around, you know, would civil society make recommendations about how to grow South Africa's revenue pool rather than looking just at the restricted is now excluding all children without birth certificates. So in the Eastern Cape, that's 36,000 children. So schools in the Eastern Cape are getting less money per capita, or less money for the children in their schools than they did 2 years ago. That means that they either reduce the amount of food they give the children for the school feeding scheme, or the amount of furniture that they can purchase, or the amount of teacher posts that they can fund. Or they physically exclude the children, which some schools are doing. They're actually escorting the children out of the classroom and taking them home. So those, you know, those kind of things, when we talk about, you know, the austerity is going to, it results in squeezes in strange ways at a provincial level, is happening on the ground. And in that case, there was dialogue by a lot of the Eastern Cape NGOs with the Eastern Cape Department of Education for 2 years. That dialogue didn't go anywhere. It was followed by lawyers' letters, and now it's in the courts. So there needs to be some forum where these kind of issues, which are half financial and half policy related, can get discussed together. And you know, whether the expert panels in place of that is a question as a coalition we need to discuss. Because the expert panel maybe concentrated on zero rating. We thought it was expanded, but because it's restricted to the 2018 fiscal framework, the ability of that panel to actually make recommendations beyond 2018 doesn't seem clear. But there does seem to be need to be a process where the broader policies can be looked at and the economic effect those policies are having on families. Just another example of where we could invest money as a quid pro quo is in the ECD subsidy for children. That ECD subsidy goes to the creches and it pays for children's food and also the salaries of care workers. And those care workers tend to be women who are all below the minimum wage and won't be included in the minimum wage because they are not paid by government, they are paid by NGOs. And they have gotten exclusion in the minimum wage process. So increasing the subsidies there would mean more food for children as well as larger salaries for mainly women. So there's lots of examples we could give if there was a forum in which we could give. Thank you.
I'm just going to respond a little bit on the question around the provision of sanitary pads. There are multiple distribution options that can be provided, similar to that of condoms. Ultimately, if you could look at providing at schools, it's a bit of a risky thing, but the way they deliver textbooks, you can be delivering pads, whatever else needs to be delivered to schools. Clinics are a useful public space in which to provide sanitary pads to young women who are not accessing schools, for example. Public institutions, so in a similar way that condoms are required to be provided in public institutions, you can provide sanitary pads. And I think it's also important to just note that where there's decent water and sanitation services that are accessible, there are reusable methods that are available that could be provided by government and so can form job creation opportunities, for example, washable sanitary pads or the use of moon cup style services. So this is something that can be done relatively cheaply and in a mechanism that really supports women's rights in South Africa and in particular focus on the girl child accessing education. I'm just going to take a quick liberty around expanding the terms of reference for the expert panel. I think one of the things that needs to be linked into the discussion is around the current fiscal rules. Of the expenditure ceiling as a mechanism for policy making at this level and to look at how that influences tax policy as well. So I don't think it's not a coincidence that the expert panel's terms of reference have been limited within looking at the 2018 framework and I think there's scope for discussion around the actual assumptions behind the type of fiscal rules that we're using currently.
Okay, thank you very much. Can we just suggest one thing? Firstly, within 7 days, we even saw it. Can you give us a brief extension of some of the reference, right? Because they're getting going and some problems. Secondly, on Professor Bula, are you people going to be here for the afternoon? Then we can respond at that time, right? Then thirdly, I think that, you know, now that well, let me put it this way, which of those carefully, since you are saying, what I'm trying to say is, listening to you now, it's seems to me that there is a framework within which we can move forward in a reasonably consensual manner, though we will never agree. And I think that Treasury, you have to come to the party, really. And they have shifted, as far as I can see. You have to shift. It's not a discussion. It's an instruction. Is anybody listening? It's an instruction, actually. So you tell Momo what we're saying to him. I'll speak to the minister in the bathroom. I'll see the house. Okay. I will go and look for it now and tell him. This is the view of the committee, that you people have to cooperate, right? On the matters, some of the matters you are raising. Now, these are potential scenarios that you gave to us. That's right, in February. Now, to be fair, also on your side, given what they have said, and we have appropriated things today, thanks to Judge Dennis Davis, more than National Treasury, mind you, anyway, for what it's worth, I think you also have to look at the situation. Whether, you know, like there's too many options you're giving us. I don't know, it makes it difficult for us. So is there no way you can reduce the options if that's possible, it'll help us. Then can I plead with you? Whatever your views about terms, we cannot subscribe to them. I'm not sure that, what the situation is, the crisis here. We can propose to them. They might reject it, right? But we will fight with them about it and then see. But the thing is, you see, you must go to this commission. And we will ensure that Treasury meets with you. But there is something that's hitting me really hard. I put the co-chair also. Actually, our program is unrealistic. There is so much to do. You're saying you're doing research, is that right? You're commissioning research. Now, you are going to finish maybe in 6-8 weeks, right? In the meanwhile, the commission's going to finish its work, the panel, it's at the end of June. So really, I don't think we can do much more than before then, but receive the response of National Treasury, your response, National Treasury's response. Yeah. So maybe bring the carbon tax bill forward and juggle our program around, but I'll confirm with the media and employer. So basically what I'm saying is, can you do your bit and badger and nudge and do other things that you have to do? You have enormous power as consumption, in theory at least, and you know, flex it. I'm not saying you must do anything wrong within the Constitution, but you're right. You carry weight, you know that, Matthew, and Neil knows it, and I'm sure the NGOs get it. You carry weight to the extent you flex it. Okay? So, you have to use that too. Don't rely on us as Parliament alone. But we want the executive, right? Not wanting the wrong word. We're urging the executive to take very seriously the four submissions that have come now, and you have to move on that. And I'm mandated, I think, by, and suddenly I can go to speak to the minister that look, you guys want to come to the and engage.
Thank you very much for now. Oh, you wanted to say something, Commissioner? Thank you, Co-Chair. We appreciate your submissions. We've just concluded a whole series of public hearings on the 2018 Division of Revenue Law. And I'm inviting you because the second round on the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill will be October, November 2018. So I invite you, because you refer to the conditional grants, etc. How is revenue divided? That's the appropriation side. So thank you for your inputs here. We'll take it further in our appropriations from the ensuing.
This is
a final
thing. We've gone 15 minutes into the night, right? But it's not a crime, because Saeed has fallen away. And so what we're going to do is that Comrade Chow will take over now. We've agreed, right, that instead of coming back at 2:15, you come back at 2:30. Good, thank you very much. And then we will, in fact, you then come because you can go to your, you're sitting at 4:00.
Yeah.
Oh, it's not really, I'm surprised, yeah. Okay, thank you all for now.
Yeah, please be precisely 2:30, that we...
Sorry. Right. Later, second for the logic, second for the
Exactly, right. So.